Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
This is Matt Demmer of Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury in Dearborn, inviting you to come down and see the all-new Lincoln MKX. We have them in stock and available for immediate delivery. Click on Demmer.com for details. Come see the all-new Lincoln MKX at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury in Dearborn.
I will eat more cookies.
I will embrace the dessert.
Get serious about dessert, like McDonald's cool, creamy chocolate banana triple thick shakes. Chocolatey banana goodness, oh yeah.
I will make time for dessert.
I will make time for dessert.
I will make time for dessert. At participating McDonald's.
This is Kevin Vogel, winner of the Toolbox Tournament 2006. Issuing a challenge to all the tool jockeys out there. Meet me February 8th at the Design and Construction Expo in Novi and see if you've got the skills it takes to win the Toolbox Tournament 2007.
Toolbox Tournament is a skills competition to determine Metro Detroit's best overall construction worker. The top three scorers nail cash prizes, including $1,000 for first place. Think you've got the right stuff? The Rift Street Team will be registering guys at job sites around town through the 26th. Or you can register online at WRIF.com. Toolbox Tournament 2007, Thursday, February 8th at the Rock Financial Showplace in Novi.
So strap on your tool belts and take the title if you can.
Toolbox Tournament 2007 is presented by CAM, CSI, and 101 WRIF. Swan's Clothing specializes in men's and women's outdoor work clothes. The selection is worth the drive. Visit Swan's Clothing in downtown Howell and stay warm this winter. Or give them a call at 800-234-0338.
Drowning Pool.
On Thursday, February 1st, get your body on the floor for the return of Drowning Pool. 101 WRIF and the O Nightclub in Windsor present Drowning Pool Thursday, February 1st. Advance tickets are on sale now. Call 519-97-ROCKS or log on to ticketweb.ca to purchase tickets online. Or you can even get tickets in person at Dr. Disc's right next door to the O Nightclub, Windsor's largest concert hall located at 671 Ouellette Avenue. $25 gets you in the door to rock with Drowning Pool at the O Nightclub on February 1st. Get your tickets now.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much and welcome, everybody. Yeah, I remember how radio is. You have to turn on the on button. I got one for Jillian Jordan as well. Jillian Jordan, our on-air producer, joining me. Hi, Jillian. Okay. No, let me see. I'm totally whacked out. Oh, no. What did I just do? Hi, there you go.
And then when you find it, then you turn it, you know, you push the pot up.
Yeah.
It's great.
That's interesting. Push the pot up.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Dial up or whatever.
Push the slider up. It looks now kind of like, everybody's seen that on television. You know what POT stands for? Potentiator.
Really?
They used to have, I thought, because when I first started radio, they had these things that looked like upside down pots. They were rheostats, just like these are. So you would turn them up to get the...
A dial.
A sense. It was a big thing. And you could kind of turn them like that, and they called it, pot you up. Like
right.
As opposed to a lot of people think that we get potted up before we come on the air.
Yeah, right.
That's true.
The old days, the 70s.
I never did that, actually.
I didn't either.
Once or twice.
I wasn't in
actually, you know, I couldn't do that. Are we supposed to talk about stuff like this? Hey, Barack Obama said that he did some coke, so I can say that, you know, I actually experimented with a little marijuana when I was, and it was a success. That experiment was terrific, but not when you're on the air.
No, definitely, you need to be very clear of mind and ready to rock and roll.
There was a very famous DJ that I knew in Detroit, she not on this station, and she would just get smoked out before going on the air.
Really?
And I asked, I said, how can you go on the air that high? And she said, I couldn't get on the air if I wasn't.
So, for real?
Well, some people, you know, use stuff like marijuana, like self-medicating, right?
So, sure.
So after all, she was quite experienced, and she used it potentially as sort of like a tranquilizer, right?
Okay.
Yeah.
Hey.
Well, it was a terrible day. You know, we always get these reports, of course, for what happens to our troops. And U.S. toll in Iraq is 27 for a deadly weekend, and hundreds, I'm sure more, for Iraqis. Two Marines died Sunday in western Iraq, and that an additional seven service members died Saturday. The deaths brought the weekend total to 27 and made Saturday the third deadliest day for United States forces since the war here, they're reporting from Baghdad, began. Now, what does this tell us? I don't know, maybe Bush sees this as justification for this escalation of the war, but what it tells me is, again, is just this total failure, forgetting about that there was no legitimate reason for the invasion to begin with, but of course that when people like this General Shinecki, remember he said that there's had to be like 300 or 400,000 American troops, they just yanked his ass right out of the service.
Oh, yeah, almost. He was out of there.
So the decisions by Bush as the commander-in-chief, you can blame it on Rumsfeld or whoever, but ultimately it's commander-in-chief's call to send in whatever, I forgot what the initial force was, maybe about 150,000, and kept it for, how many years are we almost into this now? 4 years.
That's
in
right.
March. This was a catastrophic failure on the part of Bush. So he said, oh, well, maybe we'll now try to make up for it. In the meantime, what do you tell the families of the 27 that died this week? Oh, gee, sorry about that. I guess we made a little mistake. What do we tell about the Iraqis who have died in the tens of thousands since this all began? Well, we can talk more about that. All of a sudden, taxes are going to be raised. I don't know if you've been catching much of that.
Yeah, I actually read about that this afternoon.
Well, there was two.
There's a bunch of taxes, tax things happening right now.
Again, Bush is going to urge what he calls a new tax plan for health care coverage. Suddenly, everybody, even the Republicans, are noticing that there's tens of millions of us that do not have health coverage. And the New York Times called it a 1-2 punch. Tax breaks to help lower income people buy health insurance. That's good.
Yeah, I couldn't believe when I read it. I couldn't believe it. Well, I thought, okay, what's the ruse?
Well, here,
Peter will tell me.
Tax increases for some workers whose health plans cost significantly more than the national average. So that would mean middle-class people who have well-funded health care plans.
Sure.
That's offered here at WRIF. We're going to be taxed on that. That's going to be considered income. And it is, what do they call it? Something like income in kind, or we're not getting cash, but certainly we're getting something of incredible monetary value. Right?
Okay, and where will those tax dollars go?
Well, let me see. You preempted this, but that's very cool because Pentagon requests billions more in war money.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. Pentagon seeking nearly $100 billion more for operations just in Iraq, Afghanistan, and here's the kicker, folks, elsewhere. A request that, if approved by Congress, would set an annual record for war-related spending. So this is where our money's going. And so it's bad enough that so much of our money already has gone towards this insane war policy, insane war policies of Bush, upwards $350 billion or something like that. And as I said last week, they're estimating now that this could eventually cost us over $2 trillion.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. A couple other things here that just, well, let me go back to taxes. The Detroit Free Press today, Sunday Free Press. Big headline, a taxing day. What a day would cost you if new taxes, if the legislature and governor levy up a 5% tax on services. And they list all these things you could do.
I saw that. For example, what's on there?
Everything under
services.
Pay $20 labor for oil change and tax rotation, new tax a buck.
Yeah.
A doctor's office visit costs you $80, you pay $4. I mean, it's not bad enough that you got to pay $80 to get, instead of having free medical care like every single damn country in the industrial world has, because instead of helping the citizens of the United States, this government spends it on war.
That's right.
Yeah.
And other ridiculous things.
Yes. Plumber charges you $200 to fix a burst pipe. You pay $10 additional. On and on and on. So
it all adds up, huh?
Yeah, $36.79, I guess, for all these things they list. Drop off the two kids at daycare, you get taxed. Pay carpet cleaners, you get taxed. So, I mean, here's what Governor Granholm, the Democratic governor who just was reelected, is facing. That if budget officials estimated the current imbalance at between $722 million and $900 million, in other words, almost $1 billion, and they say that unless something has changed, unless there's more revenues that it could grow to more than $2 billion in 2008. So this is where to turn. Well, I have a good idea, but here's what they say. Among capital watchers and interest groups, the idea attracting the most attention is to expand Michigan's sales and use tax to services, haircuts, plumbers, lawyers, and lawn services, to name a few. That's not attracting my attention. My attention would be to taxing the rich,
sure.
Taxing the corporations. I mean, think about, what was that creature from Black Lagoon, DeVos, that ran for governor against
Dick DeVos?
Dick DeVos, yeah. Yeah.
Right.
You don't know Dick.
How could we forget?
Right. You don't know Dick. That was one of the websites. And how much did he spend?
Of course it was.
Yeah. How much did he spend of his own personal fortune trying to buy the governorship?
Millions and millions.
Yeah. I mean, was it into the tens of millions? But in other words,
probably.
It was at least millions, and it could have been tens of millions of dollars. Let's put that into the coffers. Now, of course, that doesn't go a long way towards $900 million. But if there was a more equitable tax system, it would go a long way. But, of course, there's the blackmail. And that's what the system is always run on. Because say that we started a reasonable tax policy that said, hey, we're having bad times, and we're not going to take it out of people's pay that are making $40,000 a year, and they're going to have to pay new taxes on doctor's office visits and plumbing and oil changes and dry cleaning,
yeah.
But rather the dicks of the state,
right.
The Dick DeVos's.
Take a little more of
yeah.
the burden.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, people are having a hard time getting by just paying for those services, and sure. often foregoing the even having some of this work done because they can't afford it. Times are hard.
And the same thing with, where did that disappear to? The thing about taxing medical plans of people with good medical plans. Let me see here. It says, the basic concept is that employer-provided health insurance, now treated as a fringe benefit exempt from taxation, would no longer be entirely tax-free. Workers could be taxed if their coverage exceeded limits set by the government, but the government would also offer a new tax deduction for people buying health insurance on their own. And it's criminal that people have to buy tax insurance on their own. I mean, what do you want, folks? A war in which the hundreds of billions of dollars, magnifying up into trillions, goes to these war industries and Halliburton and all these people that are profiting grandly from our tax dollars, or would you like to have a national health program where everything is paid for?
I vote for that.
That sounds good. Let's see, more from the New York Times. The proposed plan is a startling move for a president who has repeatedly vowed not to raise taxes. Remember his daddy? He was
sure.
saying, read my lips, no new taxes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, people have said that that the Bush and the Republicans are on such a downward spiral that there could be an even greater increase. First off, a Democratic president and a veto-proof, or no, I guess you wouldn't need a veto-proof, but over 60 Democratic senators in 2008. Representative Charles Rangel, chair of the House committee that writes tax legislation, said it's bad policy. The president is trying to increase the tax liability of the middle class. The proposal is inconsistent with what the majority is seeking in the House and the Senate. Indeed.
The middle class. What middle class?
Well, it is shrinking.
Is it still there?
You know, it is there. I mean, sometimes I'll go to places like in Royal Oak or even, you know, you go to Birmingham or places like that and you go, hey, man, everything is luxury, right?
Oh, yeah. You know, I do a little dog walking on the side. It's one of those fun jobs. And I drive out to, you know, Bloomfield Hills, and I think, where do these people get all of their money? There's still a lot of it out there.
That's what my wife asked. She said, where do these people get their money? I said, I have no idea.
The McMansions everywhere?
Yeah. Mm. Here is a supplement to the Michigan Citizen that was published in December 10th. One section. There were four sections here. This is the 2007 tax foreclosure list of homes in Wayne County.
That looks like a whole section.
Yeah,
I mean,
it is.
Pages.
This is, I don't know, let me see if it's numbered. Yeah, this is 20 pages of these little teeny listings.
Wow. Ugh.
These are people whose homes are in foreclosure. I don't know if they're all getting kicked out. I'm not sure what the status is. But if you don't pay your taxes, you know, you're a goner. And there was four sections like that. So it's like approximately 80 pages of homes that are being foreclosed on for failure to pay taxes. Now, there's also something like 40, 50,000 people have had their water shut off in the city of Detroit.
Oh, no.
That, wait a minute, there's something else about you utilities. But, you know, there's elements of the middle class, like me, like you, I suppose, that are, you know, I mean, really honestly, aren't we doing okay? At least I am.
Yes, okay.
I mean, I'm not extravagant.
Right, me neither.
I don't have any big expenditures.
I used to be, but not so much anymore.
But there are people that are barely hanging on, and lots of them, and lots of them around here. And this isn't just City of Detroit. Right, it's alphabetical. So it's Brownstown Township and Canton Township and Gross Eel.
Oh, sure.
I mean, that's an upscale little
area. Right?
Yeah. So some people have been going down. Van Buren and Sumter and Grosse Pointe Farms. Wow. And gives an address. So there's a lot of people whose deal is going down.
Yeah, that's quite lengthy.
But here's what's happening. According to the Economic Policy Institute, you know, where is my little thing? Tell people what our phone number is.
Oh, 313-298-WRIF. That's right. We take phone calls.
Do you know the number by memory?
I do.
You do?
I do. What is it? Look, it's 313-298-WRIF.
No, no. I mean,
oh, the numbers? I don't. In fact, someone quizzed me last night about that. I'm like, I don't know.
313-298-9743. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan with you. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com will get you the email access to us. Newly released data from two separate sources revealed just how skewed the distribution of economic growth has been over the current recovery. Data from the Bureau of Economic Analysis through the third quarter of 2006 show that a historically high share of corporate income is going into profits and interest rather than employee compensation. Now, if you're just going, whoa, man, what the hell is that all about? What that means is that we're getting looted. Looted, that's an interesting concept. Every once in a while, when you have something like in a urban riot, you go, oh, look at those guys. They just took a pound of hot dogs out of that window. You know, I hate those people. They're looters. Shoot them on sight. Well, never mind.
You should be upset is the point.
Yeah, I guess I was going to say something. I don't think anybody should be shot on sight. I was going to say the people that are really doing the looting, and these are the people in the upper income who are taking the increased productivity that all of us exercise daily on the job to provide this income that is going way disproportionately to not like the upper third, not the upper 20%, not the upper 10%, but the upper 5 and 1%, the people that need it the least. The people that need it the least are getting it the most.
Yeah.
And a new, newly released Congressional Budget Office analysis of household incomes shows that a greater share of this capital income goes to the richest households than at any time since they began tracking such trends. This is what Bushco has put in operation. That's why I've consistently called it Bushco, Bush Incorporated. It's an economic racket to loot the middle class and the working class and transfer wealth to the upper wealth in this country. And I know somebody said, well, they made it. No, the hell they made it. They are stealing it. They're looting it. We are making it.
They may make a lot of money, but they're getting a lot of extra benefits, yeah. Shall we say.
Well, yeah, this is capitalism, and you have like a, you know, an upper elite, a ruling class, whatever the hell you want to call it, that gets rewarded disproportionately more than people down the ladder. All right, but there's different ways you can do it and different levels of income distribution. This is like the 19th century. This is like the 18th century. Let's see. This is the one.
Well, Bush is doing his job. He did exactly what he set out to do, and then some.
Yeah. Families earning more than $1 million a year saw their federal tax rates drop more sharply than any group in the country as a result of President Bush's tax cuts, according to a new congressional study. The gap between rich and poor has widened in the last several years. This is their intent. And you know what? We'll come out for a number of demonstrations, and particularly anti-war stuff. And we'll talk about what's going on with that in a little while, coming up this weekend in Washington, D.C. But most countries, they'll have enormous demonstrations over economic issues.
Oh, yeah. In Paris, there's always a lot going on
there.
Sure.
So you would think that perhaps there would, you know, that people, when they learn, well, say like all the water shutoffs and all the foreclosures. During the 1930s, there was a moratorium on housing foreclosures in the state of Michigan.
Oh.
And one of the things they did early on, and one of the reasons they had to, when the sheriff would come to throw people out, suddenly they'd be met by 200 angry neighbors saying, you're not putting these people out.
Well, maybe that needs to happen again.
Or, yeah. Or how about Jennifer Granholm? Forget about taxing my haircut. I don't get them that frequently anyways. That made me get them even less. Sheila, I'm sorry. I'll come. I won't.
She does a good job.
She does a good job. Yeah. You see, you like my hair?
Yes.
Yes. Thank you. What the hell else could you say? It's I get it. What I always say, I get it one every 6 months, whether I need it or not. Right. Actually, I'm not the hippie I used to be, am I?
No, you keep it a little shorter.
You know when I looked the most like a hippie?
When was that?
In the 90s.
Oh, yeah. The later 90s, when I kind of came around, you had it a little bit longer.
Yeah.
You were still wearing
it. But I didn't have a full beard, and my hair didn't. I mean, I used to have my hair to shoulders.
You're a hippie forever.
Well, Marilyn, I gave someone I know.
Yeah.
Said that I look like an old hippie. And I said, yeah.
And he said, thank you?
Yeah, I didn't get it. Well, here, one last thing. So how can we, first off, we got to end the war immediately. We've got to end funding for the war, which will immediately bring troops home. That's one of the calls. But this is from Robert Novak, who's this right-wing Republican flack columnist. Hideous man. But he says, will Bush back lifting the payroll tax cap? Now, the payroll tax is what we pay in withholding tax in this, what is it, FICA? Is that what it is? FICA, yeah.
FICA, right.
FICA, what a federal income. I don't know. But it goes to fund Social Security and stuff like that. So right now, everyone pays the same rate up to $97,000, and then you don't pay anymore. So some of these guys that were made from that investment firm that made like $400 million, they're not paying on $400 million. They're paying on $97,000.
Oh, that's just wrong.
Yeah. Whereas you and I mean, once you're past 97.5, I think that's the 95th percentile of income in the country. So 95% of the people are paying the full schedule of FICA taxes, but the ruling class, the elite, the economic barons, they get off with this extraordinary amount. Now, here, says the Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Paulson. Jesus, somebody would have said to me, who's the Secretary of the Treasury? I sure would have been stumped, wouldn't you?
Yes, most definitely.
But, of course, we know who the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development is, right? And we know who else, don't we? All right, let's not prove how dumb we are. He's engaged in secret bipartisan talks discussing an increase in the current $97,500 limit on personal income subject to the Social Security payroll tax. So Bush is actually having secret bipartisan meetings about raising taxes?
No.
Yeah, well, but here's what this right-wing flack Novak says. Eliminating the tax on payroll taxes, pardon me, could constitute the largest tax increase in U.S. history. I'm all for it. Estimated by the Heritage Foundation. Now, this is another right-wing dink tank. actually, I didn't even get that off. Dink tank. It's supposed to be think, but dink tank.
They're probably the one.
Yeah, they estimate that it would be $1.4 trillion over 10 years. Well, that's great. That would almost make back what these right-wing creeps are having us spend on the war in Iraq. So that's kind of fair, don't you think?
Yeah, kind of fair.
Yeah. The analysis predicted that such a step would cost nearly a million jobs and more than $55 billion in projected personal savings. So what? Again, here's the blackmail. They're saying if you make everyone pay their fair share of taxes, we're going to lose jobs. This is BS. I mean, they just always say this. So tax the rich. That's what I say. Don't tax the middle class. Don't tax the working class. And well, I don't think the poor get taxed. But why are there so many poor people in such a rich country? Where's my little mouse? Here we go. All right. Can't even see if we do. We have any callers? Oh yeah, we have lots of them. never.
I'm afraid to ask.
No, it's just I'm looking at our phone screener and pal Al's spelling.
Oh.
I won't embarrass you. Let's see. Okay. Here is Mike in Birmingham. And Mike, thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Werby with Jalene Jordan, and you called 313-298-WRF. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Mike Gibson calling.
Hi, Mike.
Hi, I just wanted to, I guess, like, in among the Catholic Church, there's been a lot of talk about supposedly Roe versus Wade may be overturned in the next election. Like, at least that's the scenario that I seem to get from these programs that they have on TV, like Catholic programming, is that supposedly there's some priest, some kind of priest somewhere that's involved in elections or something.
Well, he doesn't have to. What Bush did was to stack the court with right-wing anti-choice justices, so there is a chance that it could be hobbled. I just don't know whether the resulting social and political chaos that would result, would they dare to do that? I mean,
it would be ugly.
Yeah, the court has always historically said, since they're appointed for life, the justices, that they're above politics, but they certainly aren't. And for instance, when the court upheld segregation in the 1890s, it knew that that racism and segregation and racist terror was the common coin of the land. And when it finally made this brave decision in 1954 to overturn segregation, they also knew that the times they were a-changing. So would they actually overturn Roe v. Wade, even though that Bush has appointed these right-wing Catholics, including the Chief Justice? I don't know. I tend to think not. But thank you for raising that, Mike. Let's go to Joe. Joe's in Canton. Joe, hi. I hope you don't have one of those houses that's being foreclosed on out there in Canton that I read. Joe, you with us? Oh, I see. This is one of these things where you got to turn his mic on. Joe, hi. It's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air.
Hi, Jalene. Hi, Peter. How you doing?
Doing good.
Good.
You made a comment before, and I'm for what you were talking about, Peter.
Yeah.
I believe you said something about Dick DeVos, you know, the person we can never forget.
Yeah.
He spent, somewhere I've read, $37 million on his campaign. I mean, what percentage of taxes did he pay?
I don't know.
You know, the rich, how much do they contribute anymore?
Well,
and I want to name a second question. I also want to name something. I want you to name something that Mr. Bush was ever successful at.
Oh gosh, that's a good one.
You know, what are we need that music from like the quiz show.
I'm going to have to really think about that.
Has he done anything right? I mean, like Mussolini made the trains run on time in Italy, so here was a
dictator. But pretty big.
I don't know. Actually, the wealthy do contribute in terms of overall revenues, a considerable amount. I mean, that's, nowhere near what they should. I mentioned this before, up till 1960, that when you made over $6 million, your tax rate went up to 90%.
No kidding.
So on the seventh million, you kept $100,000, the government took $900,000.
How about that?
Yeah. But
a balloon payment of sorts.
Well, come on. But thank you for that, Joe. Let's see. I mean, we would look so.
I'm trying so hard, Peter.
So he's.
He's kind of to animals. He has a couple.
No,
of
he dropped Barney. Don't you remember?
Oh, that's right. Okay, well, there goes that.
Well, come on. This
he was a good dad. You think?
With those two hellions.
I love the Bush twins. Come on.
Why? They should
they're
be
the only two. They're the only Bushes that I like.
Maybe just because they're party animals.
I know.
But, you know, shouldn't they, I mean, shouldn't, Bush be offering them up as, Marine recruits?
Sure he should.
Yeah, they could write a book. Isn't one of them, isn't Barbara or Jenna, she's got a book in the works.
For real?
For real, yeah.
Oh, no, scared of that.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. This is not for right wingers, the few of you that are left, but for liberals and leftists. Has Bush done anything good? One single thing? I mean, like Nixon, he signed the Clean Air Act and the Environmental Protection Act, and you could say, well, that was decent. That was decent.
Mm-hmm.
And like Lyndon Johnson, who started the war in Vietnam on the basis of a lie. He signed civil rights legislation. What about Reagan? I can't think of anything good he did either. I mean, these people are
this
awful.
Is a tough question.
yeah, they really are terrible. Let's see. Here's Carol in Detroit. Carol, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
Hi, Jolene and Pete. I agree. I can't think of anything that his dad's friends didn't bail him out of.
Yeah, that's right. He even traded Sammy Sosa, didn't he?
Right. but the reason I called was I know Bush wants to, the Bush bloodbath is going to continue. But this morning on TV, I didn't catch where the guy was at. Somebody, a veteran that came back that had a lot of big medical bills.
Uh-huh.
They're having this spaghetti dinner for him because he used to be a cop. And I think that is terrible. They're not even taking care of the guys when they get back.
No, that is terrible, Carol. In fact, I was going to mention that, and I put together public service announcements for the station. And there was a Hazel Park police officer. Actually, the benefit is kind of on hold, so I won't mention it. If it wasn't, I would. And the man had contracted lung cancer, and it's another one of these things. They're having spaghetti dinners. And I thought, this is what I like to see, communities coming out to support its members.
Yeah, people, power of the people.
Yeah. On the other hand, what the hell I mean, the costs are so extravagant. I mean, what are they going to make? $500, $1,000, $2,000 at the most? Whereas, what will that get you? The aspirins are $10 a piece.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So it's an absolute disgrace that there's not medical care in general, let alone for returning vets that are going to need it, throughout their life, thanks to Bush's war. All right, thank you so much. We'll be right back.
Looking out there.
The pictures.
The podcast.
The blog.
The special features you just don't get.
Anywhere else.
Super freaking cool.
Get them online at WRIF.com.
I shall do just that.
Or check us out at MySpace.com/WRIF.
Guaranteed to be extreme.
Because we can always use more friends, and we won't be naked.
Does anyone else smell Astroglide?
101.
WRIF.
People are sexy and clever, and they always say something funny right before a commercial break.
Everything that rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. And joined in the studio with our on-air producer, Jalene Jordan. Hi,
yes.
Jalene.
Hi, glad to be here.
And yeah, there is an open line, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. And calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I haven't even given a peek. I'm terrible, aren't I? Probably people are...
We do that sometimes, because we just get so into the show and the calls and that kind of thing.
Quite a few of them. You know, here's somebody, actually, Bush's contributions. We need to get you a screen over there. Not to try to take up too much time in the air, but I do have Bush's contributions. Probably not intentional, but Bush has caused some Americans, me included, to wake up and look at the horrors of our foreign policy.
Well, okay, there's something.
People were doing this before, but the sheer gall and unbelievability of Bush's actions have made us do something unpopular but necessary. Take responsibility. This is from Mickey, by the way. If it happened slower, we may not have noticed. And so he goes, I hope it, let me see. Change is coming. At least we can be sure that the future is going to be different. I hope it goes smoothly, but I'm ready for anything. Oh, I was going to start the show with this piece of bad news. The keepers of what's called the Doomsday Clock plan to move its hands forward next Wednesday. That was last Wednesday, to reflect what they call worsening nuclear and climate threats to the world.
Wow.
Hey, when that happens... The symbolic clock. It's on my website, peterwerby.com.
Right, explain this to me.
Okay. It's maintained by the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. It's currently set at 7 minutes to midnight, with midnight marking global catastrophe.
Oh, my.
The group did not say in which directions the hand would move. Well, hello. But the news release previewing it at an event said the change was based on worsening nuclear climate threats to the world. The major new steps reflects growing concerns about a second nuclear age. Now, unsecured nuclear materials in Russia, nuclear ambitions in Iran and North Korea, the continuing launch-ready status of 2,000 of the 25,000 nuclear weapons held by the U.S. and Russia.
Mm.
So, and Bush said he didn't want to do any kind of nuclear disarmament. Putin did. The president of Russia.
Right, but and all of this, though, this so-called disarmament really is more of a storage situation, isn't it?
Yeah, except there's 2,000 of them that are on launch-ready status. So
yeah,
Russia has
right
all. I mean, so as we talk, Detroit, where we're broadcasting from, is targeted by Russian nuclear missiles.
How do we sleep at night ever?
I don't know. We're in major denial.
Oh, wait. It's called Ambien. That's why it's so out of control.
Well,
I don't take it, but I know a lot of people who do.
Let's see. It was as close as 2 minutes. The clock was the doomsday clock. 2 minutes to midnight in 1953 following U.S. and Soviet hydrogen bomb tests. And as far away as 17 minutes to midnight in 1991 after the superpowers reached agreement on a nuclear arms reduction. Hello. Well, who was president? Oh, yeah. Bill Clinton.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Now it's over 7, so it's up 10 minutes. A Harvard study concluding that cigarette makers have for years deliberately increased nicotine levels in cigarettes to make them more addictive led to renewed calls for greater federal oversight of the industry. So if you're wondering why you can't kick smoking, it's because they are keeping you addicted.
Yeah, that's true.
Isn't that sweet?
Well, I pretty much quit smoking, but once in a while when you have that, you know, that cosmopolitan, you say, hey, could I have one of those smokes? But somehow I've done it. I don't know.
Cosmopolitans, yes. Cigarettes.
I know. Yeah. They're so bad.
Here's Chris in Harrison Township. Chris, is Jalene and Peter. You're on the air.
Hi, Jalene and Peter. How are you tonight?
Doing well, thanks.
Good to hear. Yeah, I wanted to call. It's been a few weeks since the passing of Gerald Ford, you know, former President Gerald Ford, and there was a couple things that weren't brought up, which I think should be, and I'm glad I have the chance here to speak my mind here. What they emphasized mostly was that even though it was unpopular at the time, the pardon of Nixon was judged by history to have been a good move. Well, be that as it
may. Wait. Who is history? I wanted to see Nixon frog marched out of the White House in handcuffs,
well,
you know?
Me too.
Not, I mean, where did he go? He had a, what was his, like, island estate?
San Clemente.
San Clemente, yeah. The call was San Quentin, not San Clemente.
or what was the other one? Jail to the chief, not hail to the chief.
I love that.
But what happened was is that it was given a lot of attention
right.
At the time. And there was a couple things they didn't happen to mention. One thing concerned the Vietnam War and the growing protest movement, even amongst congressmen and senators. It was mostly Democratic congressmen and senators, of course, that opposed Vietnam, but there were a few Republicans, too.
Sure.
The leaders of that movement were Pete McCluskey of California, Congressman Pete McCluskey, and Michigan's own Don Riegel, who later switched parties and became a Democratic senator for three terms.
Right.
There was a well-publicized meeting where Nixon would receive McCluskey and Riegel and hear their grievances on Vietnam. What happened was they had that meeting, and then a half an hour later they go back to the House floor, and who is there but the Republican minority leader, Gerald Ford, denouncing McCluskey and Riegel for their stands on the war, speaking pretty much verbatim everything that was said in the meeting with Nixon. So obviously it was taped, and somebody was typing up exactly what Ford was supposed to say and sent it over rip and read. Which, and the point I wanted to make was that one of the charges against Nixon in the impeachment was, you know, sheer invasion of privacy, you know, mm-hmm. both with the Watergate buggings and the buggings of the Oval Office. Yeah, because a lot of people were taped without their knowledge, including those two Republican senators. You know, that they did it. They blatantly used that for political advantage against their own. So, of course, you know, Riegel changed, of course, but at the time they were both Republican senators, and that's basically the same thing that's going on with the Bush administration today. I heard that Senator Susan Collins of Maine, the, you know, a well-respected moderate Republican who's well-respected on both sides of the aisle, that she went to Iraq, and she came back and had some meeting at the White House where she saw Bush and got with them and said, I just got back from Iraq, I'd like to tell you what I saw. And what he did was he did the famous, you know, arm-in-arm pose for the cameras and took her right to something like the fourth highest-ranking person in the National Security Council. In other words, he farmed out a respected U.S. senator to a low-level
bureaucrat. Well, he was also strong-arming her. One thing about Gerald Ford, everybody says, oh, he did no harm. Forget that his Secretary of State was the monstrous Henry Kissinger, which gave the go-ahead for the Indonesian government to invade East Timor, which wound up with the deaths of 300,000 people. Henry Kissinger is probably the most prominent free or at-large war criminal responsible for the deaths of millions of people in Chile, in East Timor, in Vietnam. And he was advising Bush on Iraq. I mean, this is truly frightening. And doesn't say much for Gerald Ford, as far as I'm concerned. Thank you, Chris. Appreciate your call. Hey, we got somebody else wants to talk about Nixon. It's Al in Ferndale. Al, hi. It's Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan.
Hey, how you doing, Peter? It's Al Golby. Hi, Jalene.
Hi.
Hi, Al.
Yeah, I got to sit on Vietnam. I was over there in 69 and 70. And Nixon, that was the best thing that they could do. Was get him out of there.
Yeah. Just too bad that he ever got in there.
Yeah. Yeah. But what I really wanted to touch on was, I think, go back to Kennedy.
Uh-huh.
Kennedy. It wouldn't happen to Kennedy. I think they would have pulled us all out of there.
There's some thought, and one of the speculations is that Kennedy was assassinated because he had intended to pull the troops out, realizing that it was a lost cause as early as the early 60s. Some historians dispute that. It's kind of, you know, we're probably going to have to wait a while before these secret histories become known.
Yeah, because I watched the movie, and, you know, it was so realistic.
Yeah.
And, you know, he wanted to pull us through. I was older, 69 and 70, and he was just getting, you know, he wanted to pull us out of there, and that's how I felt that. You know, you know as well as I do probably why they did what they did.
Yeah, that's very possible. Thank you, Al. I appreciate your call. If you'd like to get yours on the air, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. And here's Tim in Hazel Park. Tim, it's Peter and Jolene. Hi.
Hi, how you doing? My statement was more referring to what you were talking about earlier. I was in my car heading home listening to your conversation regarding tax, poor versus the rich.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's, in my opinion, if you solely intend on taxing the rich for their whatever luxury items, and even not luxury items, it's what you're talking about. You were talking about taxing even the poor for what dry cleaning and all of that. The rich, even if you do intend to soak the rich as a just a general statement, mostly all you would really be encouraging is for the rich to just cut their spending. And what you were actually talking about earlier.
They've got such opulent lifestyles, and they've got so much expendable income that they're not going to cut it. And in fact, I mean, they're getting too much income to begin with. The income that is produced belongs to the people that have been creating it. That's us, the middle class, us, the working class, even the poor. And it's what I said before. There's this great, resurgence in wealth being produced. And rather than it going equitably to both the owners, but, you know, as happens under capitalism, but also to the people that need it the most, that's the classes below the wealthy. Well, they don't need more money. They want more money because they're pathologically greedy. Well,
they need that new boat.
Well, there'd be plenty of money for them to get new boats. I mean, the wealthy in the European countries and in Canada that have a much more equitable tax system and provide so much more for their citizens than we do, you know, the rich fat cats have big boats and big cars and what have you. But they don't make hundreds of millions of dollars. In fact, remember last week we were talking about these guys that failed, like the CEO of Home Depot. They said, okay, you know, you really screwed up. You're out of here. Here's $150 million.
What is that all about?
I mean, why don't they give them $2 million and give the rest of it to their employees who are valuable beyond belief?
What you were talking about, Dick DeVos spending all of his money on his campaign, I think he would have been very much more able to influence the voting population if he would have just donated it to the put it in the coffers, like you said. Although you were correct in saying that wouldn't quite make a dent in what the debt there was, but it would have far more benefited him just to donate it to the people than it would for him to just spend it on his campaign.
Well, if you think about it, we have, how much longer is this going to go on, but it appears to be the case right now that we are the wealthiest country in the world, and we hear that all the time. And what does that mean? It means that there is this aggregate wealth. I mean, there is a total wealth in this country, yet we have the highest percentage by far of poor people than any industrial country in the world. We have the most people without health insurance. We're the only country without a national health program. We have the highest incidence of infant mortality, the worst medical, all that.
The insurance scam we have going on out there.
All the indices of human welfare are the lowest of all the industrialized countries. So where is all this money going? I mean, you know, if we got $100 and there's 10 people, you can be, you know, communistic and give everybody, what did I say, 10 people? Yeah, you got $100, you can give everyone 10 bucks, or you can give somebody 90, one guy $90, and the other 9 split the 10 bucks. I mean, that's where we're heading. That's where we're heading. Or you can, you know, split it up, leave the system intact. You know, we're not talking revolution or anything here. We're just talking about some decent fairness so the hardworking people of this country don't have to worry so much. So you don't have 80 pages of tax delinquency foreclosures published in the daily newspaper. But thank you, Tim. I appreciate it.
I want to know how much Dick DeVos spent on all of those Amway commercials. You don't watch a lot of TV, but we were inundated with Amway commercials.
Yeah.
And, oh, life is so good, and I love my job and things like that. But now they've kind of trickled away.
Well, he was getting a lot of flack I don't know if you... were you back in town? Yeah, you were back in town, but you weren't.
Yeah.
Oh, you weren't doing the show.
Right.
That's right. People were talking about Amway as Scamway and what have you.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah.
In fact, Drew and Mike, our morning show here in Detroit, they did like a whole, I heard them one morning. It was about an hour just dogging Amway, and I can't remember this. I forgot it already. Their deal, their little business deal. And the next day, these Lincoln Explorers, a whole convoy of them come up, and there is the Dick himself.
Oh, yes. Yes, he showed up. And Drew and Mike have a lot of power in this town, yeah. That's for sure.
And, you know, they, if Dick DeVos, you know, if you say, like if I said, that Amway's a pyramid scheme, a scam, I mean, and he'd have to say to me, back it up. Tell me how. And yeah. I probably, to be quite honest, wouldn't be able to do it. I mean, if I did a lot of research, and even if I did a lot of research just on my own, he probably has enough facts to refute it. On the other hand, I sure would like to put him up against the man that wrote this book exposing the Amway practices. I don't want to talk about Amway, folks.
Change subject. Yeah. Sorry, yeah. Peter.
By the way, open lines at 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. And here's Chuck in Davison. Chuck, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You were saying, did Bush ever do anything good? I mean, don't get me wrong. I think it's the worst thing that ever happened to America, but I recently read in the National Geographic that by presidential decree, he created the Northwest Hawaiian Islands Marine Wildlife Sanctuary, where I guess out there in the Pacific around Midway and stuff, all the birds are eating all the pollution and dying and stuff, so they're keeping the people out and scientists are going in trying to save them or something.
That's good. That's good.
Yes.
I mean, if you hold that up against the fact that he still wants, he's going to talk in, on his sorry State of the Union speech on Tuesday, he's going to talk about, the global warming. Remember, this was the guy that said there was no such thing. But,
I'm sure the scale tips against him, you know, but there is one small little thing I can point out.
I appreciate that.
Oh, just one little thread of good is okay in our book.
Thank you, Chuck. I appreciate that. So the guy is not 100% evil, just 99.9. Speaking of stuff like that, ExxonMobil. And will ExxonMobil ever be forgotten for having the CEO that retired with a $400 million retirement fund? What's his name? Raymond? That's out of my brain. ExxonMobil.
Raymond, very rich man.
Yeah. Now, see, that's what I mean about pathologically greedy. The guy's in his late 60s, right? And they're giving him a retirement package, and they're giving him $400 million.
Whew. That's a lot of money.
Say he lives to be what?
90?
Yeah, my dad's going to be 92 next month, a couple of weeks.
Still playing tennis.
Yeah, no, he's not playing tennis anymore. He's slowed a little.
But he's moving.
Swimming. He's swimming. Hi, okay. Dad. He's
Hi,
listening.
Dad.
And what time is 12? No, he's not up. ExxonMobil Corporation gave $16 million to 43 ideological groups between 1998 and 2005 in a coordinated effort to mislead the public by discrediting the science behind global warming, according to the Union of Concerned Scientists. The report by the science-based nonprofit advocacy group mirrors similar claims by Britain's leading scientific academy. Last September, the Royal Society wrote the oil company asking it to halt support for groups that, quote, misrepresented the science of climate change. And so the Associated Press, they called ExxonMobil. They did not immediately respond to requests for comments. Many scientists, now see, they even do this. I mean, and this is the way the news is presented. Now, this is one of these things, like this is not a lie. Many scientists say accumulating carbon dioxide and other heat-trapping gases from tailpipes and smokestacks are warming the atmosphere like a greenhouse, melting Arctic sea ice, alpine glaciers, and disturbing the lives of animals and plants. It's not many scientists. It's all but the ones that aren't being paid by ExxonMobil.
Yeah, exactly.
There's no serious climatologist. And who's that moron novelist? He's out of my brain. The guy that wrote like way back the Andromeda Strain and all that. He's got these. Oh man, Creighton? No, I don't know. Somebody will tell us. Call TalkYes at yahoo.com. He's got this anti-global warming book, and then at the back he has all these resources. And the resources are these paid whores
for
ExxonMobil. You know, I shouldn't say that.
Why?
Whores.
Oh, because
sex workers.
Now, yes, they are.
They're decent folks.
That's right. Yeah. I was in Amsterdam. I saw them.
Oh, okay. Good.
But we know.
I wondered where you were for the last.
where you get the health benefits over there, where it's a little bit cleaner.
You know, you missed my interview with Carol. I never thought of this name suddenly. Leigh, and she wrote. She wrote a book called The Scarlet Harlot, Memoirs of an Unrepentant Whore.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
What a title.
You would have loved her. She was incredible. And she was probably in her early 50s.
Sure.
She's been a prostitute for, I think she was, since she's early 20s. She says she still has a few clients, but people she's just had for a long, long time.
Yeah.
But mostly she does advocacy work for sex workers.
Well, you know, that's a whole other segment on this show, isn't it, Peter?
Yeah. All right. In fact, we'll talk about our interviews when we come back. Marianne, hang on. You're next when we come back. And there are open lines, 313-298-WRIF.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Another dream goes up in the smoke.
dreary gray skies.
The hell with this.
Don't say it!
Riffs Maui Dive 2007. Presented by Budweiser. Just keep your radio locked on 101 WRIF. When you hear Big Daddy shout those three magic words, you could win the ultimate getaway.
Ready for some fun in the sun?
A week-long trip for two to the sun and surf of Kaanapali Beach in Maui. With your host with the most, a big kahuna, Arthur Pithallow. Maui Dive 2007. Listen and win. Exclusively from Budweiser. This is beer and your official Maui Dive station. 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
Baby!
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our second hour. Joining me in the studio is Jalene Jordan. Hi, Jalene.
Hi, Peter.
And our phone number, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Good talk show hosts sum up what they're talking about in order to encourage more listeners.
Oh, yeah?
At 1 a.m. Eastern time, if you're elsewhere in the country or the world, you can do the math. Do you know this thing about they do Greenwich, mean time, is in Greenwich, England, and then I think we're like minus five. Greenwich Mean Time minus
five.
Is
that what we are?
Like minus six.
I had to ask someone once.
Yeah. But well, let's just call it 1 a.m. Eastern Time. Yeah.
All right.
And then you're doing overnights tonight?
Yes, I'll be on until Drew and Mike come in.
Everything that rocks here on WRIF. But
that's right.
At 1 a.m., I'm going to be interviewing Jim Motovalli. He's the editor of E, the environmental magazine. He's going to be talking about the Detroit Auto Show that's still going on, right?
Today was the last day.
Oh, really? I was going to go there, but I went to the refrigerator show instead. I thought
What?
No.
Okay.
They're all the same.
All right.
And Heather Vokush. Her name is spelled W-O-K-U-S-H, and I called her Vokush, or something about it. It's Heather Vokush, and she called me, recorded early in the week, from Vienna, Austria.
No kidding. Did she call you Peter Werby?
Werba.
Werba.
Yeah. So advertising in German. And radio advertising is Werbefunken.
That sounds like a Volkswagen.
I know. But she wrote the Progressive's Handbook, Get the Facts and Make a Difference Now.
Nice.
And we can do it. I mean, think about the war in Iraq. Let me back up a bit. People said, oh, Bush never listened to us. We had millions of people in the street before the war, February 15, 2003, here and all over the world. And this guy just went right ahead. He's the imperial president. Maybe everything we're doing just doesn't make any difference. But as she said, we got the facts and we made a difference. And Bush is on the run. We're driving him down. We got to drive him out.
Absolutely. And there's an opportunity to do that en masse coming up on the 27th, Saturday, in D.C., and you can take a bus.
Right. Actually, the buses for Detroit are filled. Let me see. Where is this email?
Well, I'm glad about that.
Yeah, well,
Sigrid
wrote in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com, and she said, our two buses for leaving for Washington for January 27th for the big demonstration are full. I think Ann Arbor still has some seats if people want to go. And you can go to MichiganPeaceWorks.org, MichiganPeaceWorks.org, which is a good site anyway because they have all these, if I'm right, I will click on it to make sure that, in fact, it is what it is. Yeah, it's great. This is one particular group, voted best local activist group in Current Magazine 3 years running.
Hey, congratulations.
It's like a restaurant or something. That's good. And the hundreds and hundreds of people will be going to Washington, D.C. from Michigan. But there's tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, of course, who have anti-war sentiments very actively. Obviously, the majority of people just think that Bush has totally screwed everything up in Iraq and wants us out of there. But he continues on. You know, I heard some right-wing talk show host that buys his own time on this local AM station.
Oh, okay.
And he was saying, what's your alternative? What's your alternative to everybody? You don't have any alternative.
And yelling like that,
yeah,
too,
yelling
right?
Yelling like that. And he, some guy got in and he said hello, and the guy started to say, he says, well, what's your alternative? And he said, well, he says, I don't think we should get out. He said, I wasn't saying that. He said, oh.
Nice.
But that is the Republican mantra, that the opponents of the war have no alternative. Hello, they hear about the Iraq study group, his daddy's friends that tried to bail him out. And you hear about Congressman Murtha that for the last 2 years has been suggesting a way to get out rather than more death. 27 GIs killed over the weekend. And now, U.S. Representatives Lynn Woolsey of California, Barbara Lee of California, co-chairs of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, Maxine Waters from L.A., and she's the founder of the Out of Iraq Caucus. There is in the House of Representatives an Out of Iraq caucus.
Yeah.
A little freeze there on the brain. That is called Out of Iraq.
Wonderful.
And so they're challenging Bush on alternative proposals for Iraq. They've laid out, they want new Iraq legislation that, let's see here, introduced the Bring the Troops Home and Iraq Sovereignty Restoration Act. New legislation which would force Bush to withdraw all U.S. forces currently in Iraq without 6 months.
Well, I'm glad to hear about it, but will they be able to do anything, make any difference? That's the thing, you know? I mean, we're all hopeful, right?
Well, remember I said last week about how Nixon almost lost the army, that there was these great mutinies and revolts, and they just were afraid that the army would stop fighting. Well, now the American military, this is according to the Military Times. You can go to militarycity.com, militarycity.com, pardon me, and they're the Army Times, the Navy Times, the Air Force Times, the Marine Times. And the American military, once a staunch supporter of President Bush in the Iraq War, has grown increasingly pessimistic about chances for victory. For the first time, more troops disapprove of the president's handling of the war than approve of it. Barely one-third of service members approve of the way the president is handling the war. Only 35% of the military members polled this year said they approve. In this year's poll, only 41% of the military said the U.S. should have gone to war in Iraq.
Wow.
Down from 65% in 2003. That's interesting. A third of the military didn't even think about it when he was lying his ass off.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So even it's not just a public thing. It's now, you know, in the trenches.
Indeed. All right. Let's go back to our phones. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Marianne in Dearborn. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good evening, Peter, Jolene. I was wondering if you've heard about this Real ID Act that was passed in May of 05 that's supposed to go into effect of 08, and it's supposed to... it's supposed to get access to our medical records, our financial info, and we're not supposed to leave the country unless we have national identification cards.
Huh. Well, I know.
It's part of H.R. 4118. I heard about it on Air America the other day for the first time.
Was it passed?
Yes, it was passed in May of 05. It's called part of the real. It was an addendum to one bill, something that was slipped in there. That I don't think that they were reading the fine print into one of these bills that starts in May of 08. That's when it goes into effect.
Well, I do know, Marianne, that everyone is going to need a passport by 08, and there is a lot of concern that people that go to Canada regularly and Canadians that come here are going to need passports. And the problem is that passports are almost $100. So if you want to just go to the casino or just go there to sample some of the fine food or look at Detroit from the other side of the river, you're not going to be able to do it unless you have a passport. In fact, I went over to Windsor the other day with a couple of friends, and I forgot to ask them, and we got over there. And usually the Canadian people are real glad to have Americans because they know we're there to spend money. So this woman started saying, you think you go to Europe and not have any proper identification? We're a foreign country from you. You know, and so I had my passport, so I was just laying low. And they're going, we're sorry. There were two young guys that I was with. And she let us in, though.
Well, that's good. So, well, it's not required yet.
No, but they did not have proof of birth.
Oh, a birth certificate. Only a driver's license?
They had just driver's license.
Okay,
yeah.
I see.
Yeah. All right. Well, maybe other people know more about this, Marianne. But Bush is trying to put the screws on all of our constitutional rights.
Pretty soon it'll be that corneal test.
Yeah.
Flash your eyes and figure out who you are.
Here's Tim in Detroit. Tim, it's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
Hey, Jolene. Pete, how are you doing tonight?
Good.
I just wanted to back up real quick Marianne's assertion, actually, that the Real ID Act was slipped into a tsunami bill relief.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it was done on one of those middle-of-the-night deals, you know, where a lot of the members are actually gone. And some of these Republicanoids typically, I mean, said, why don't we put this stuff in to, effectively keep our campaign going regarding, fighting terror and so on.
Hmm.
But it's funny, you know, how they claimed, the Republicans, you know, how unsafe we are from terrorists. Well, on Wednesday, the government actually backed off its terrorist surveillance program in the sense that now the government's going to have to seek warrants from FISA.
Well, wait a minute. Let's back up on this. It was exposed that Bush was illegally and unconstitutionally violating the laws. This is a high crime and misdemeanor.
What?
That it came out that he was secretly spying by domestic surveillance programs without the prescribed judicial supervision that was required by this Surveillance Act. And now, all of a sudden, that Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez said that it's going to submit its domestic surveillance program to judicial supervision. Well, isn't that nice? That's what's required by law. We have a lawless regime in Washington. But go ahead.
Well, what I wonder about also, too, is, Gonzalez claimed he had gone to the court a week before Wednesday. And the question still is, when he went there for the warrant, was it just a one-off, in other words, to cover all surveillance for the future, or would he have to go to the court every time?
Well, that's what's so scary about this law, that it's a secret court, the FISA court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, and FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act.
Yeah.
The late 70s, because what Bushco, what this regime that's bound and determined to roll back the constitutional guarantees that began in the late 18th century, it required that they come and get. I mean, imagine this: they have a secret court that they can go to, and yet they didn't even want to do this. They wanted to show that the branch of the executive had dictatorial powers with no supervision whatsoever. So there's nobody looking at who Bush is surveilling. And he's saying, well, don't you want terrorists to be surveilled? Don't you want to know that you're safe? Well, is that who they're doing surveillance of? Or are they doing surveillance of me and you? Or are they doing surveillance of the press corps? We don't know that because there's no supervision.
I don't think Quakers are terrorists. Supposedly, they've been surveyed for the last several years.
Yeah. Well, Gonzalez, who deserves to be impeached on any number of grounds, including his involvement in the torture program that Bush and Rumsfeld and Cheney et al. Put forth, he keeps using this phrase that the old program compromise the need for, quote, speed and agility. And like so much that comes out of the Bush regime, it's just a blatant lie. The idea is that they get some notification that someone's about to blow up, Cobo Hall with us in there, watching some. And if they got to go to the court and then, gee, they'll miss that. Well, they know full well that they can begin an immediate tap. And then within, I think it's 72 hours, then they have to go to the court and say, hey, look, we needed the speed and agility of an immediate tap, but we had to do it because, and will you give this ex post facto approval? And there's virtually been no rejection by this court since the late 70s, but Bushco doesn't even want that. He wants to be able to operate fully without any constitutional supervision. It's extraordinarily frightening.
A lot of this, and in a sense, sort of the build-up, sort of a corporate state where you have a lot of corporations that are involved, and the government sort of a front for a lot of, let's say, their building activities. Let's say prison camps and you know contractors and so on.
Do you think?
That's what I think. Yeah.
All right, Tim. Thank you very much. And so you're thinking, why did they give in? I mean, why did Bushco suddenly agree to what they said they would never do? There were court suits being brought against them, and just like what happened at Guantanamo, whenever they're challenged in court and they know they have no constitutional leg to stand on, they suddenly say, okay, we can prosecute somebody like they brought forth, the dirty bomber, Padilla.
Oh, sure, Jose.
Yeah, because there was challenges. They're saying, wait a minute, you've taken this American citizen, you arrested him on American territory, and he's being held incommunicado in total violation of the Fourth Amendment. He's being interrogated, cruel and unusual punishments. And so he's being challenged. They say, okay, we'll bring him up for regular.
So they go ahead and do that. But then there are all of the other situations like that are still kind of under the radar, I'm sure. Yeah.
Here, the critics of the administration, this is from the New York Times, said they suspected that one goal of the new arrangements made by Bush was to derail lawsuits challenging the program in conventional federal courts. Ann Beeson, associate legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union, says it's another clear example of the government playing a shell game to avoid accountability and judicial scrutiny.
Well, par for the course.
Yeah, I mean, is there a Republican out there, if those of you that are left, that denies this? I mean, why would they first violate the FISA law, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and then all of a sudden switch gears? What's up with that? Michael Crichton, by the way, thanks to many of you who called in. That was the author. That wing nut. I wonder what he's saying now. Whether when it's come out that I wonder if ExxonMobil paid him.
Well, that wouldn't surprise me.
Right. Let's see. Here's Toby. Toby, where are you calling from? Munich?
I live near Jackson, sir, but I work in Detroit.
Okay. What is the name of the town you're calling from?
Munich.
Where's that? Near Jackson.
That's northeastern Jackson County, sir.
Okay, go ahead. You're on the air. You're for revolution?
Well, I'm not necessarily saying that we should just go out and start murdering people or trying to take over in a violent way, but in order to change things, sir, it's going to take a unified effort from people all across this country, the working class people and the poor, in order to change this system. And I propose that somebody take the lead and we all designate a week and we all just sit at home. We don't go buy gas, we don't buy food, or we don't do anything. I realize people's occupations or people's bills are contingent upon them working every day. But in order to change the system, that's basically the only way that I see to change it is to hurt the rich where it's going to hurt them, it's in their pockets. If we stay home, we don't buy anything, we don't buy any gas, then in a few days, I would expect that they would be asking us what we want.
Well, I'll tell you, Toby, there's a few instances in American history. Essentially, what you're calling for, not so much a revolution, but what, strictly speaking, is called a general strike, is that the entire working class withholds its labor for some political goal. Now, there's been some general strikes that have preceded revolutions, and some of them not so, and pretty recently, like in Ukraine, where essentially a whole society stopped and brought down the government. But one of the things that it's really necessary, and there was general strikes in Toledo and Minneapolis and Seattle in the earlier part of the 20th century, and it was really predicated on people being organized. You'd have to have some mechanism through which you first could announce this that would get some legitimacy in the media, which I think would be very difficult. Or you would have to have great amounts of organization, and the rulers have successfully atomized all of us. So we approach their organized efforts, because they're organized through the government, they're organized through the corporations, as you're getting at, or as I guess that was Tim, in such a manner that they have immense economic power. They have, in fact, the power of strangulation. They have the power of blackmail, where most of us who are non-union have very little power. And the power comes when people unite. And as we know throughout American history, that the major changes have come outside of the government by groups demanding change, whether it's the union movement or the civil rights movement or the anti-slavery movement or what have you. So here's what I think. One more thing. I'm sorry. I'll let you talk. I'll let you respond. One of the things I think that is the most interesting about what you're saying is that things have gotten to this point with so many people in this country. Hey?
Yes, sir. They yeah. definitely have. I think it's a travesty what's happened.
I'll tell you, one group, a radical group, and I don't say that disparagingly because yeah, you can be radical and good as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, the founding fathers were pretty radical. The women who wanted the right to vote were pretty radical. They and there was a group that was active, a labor union called the Industrial Workers of the World, and they were pretty big in a lot of states during the early part of the 20th century. They're still around. They don't have anything like they used to, but you can go to IWW.org if you're on the Internet. But thank you. Thank you for bringing that up. Oh, by the way, we were talking about the power of the people. And probably, you know, I forgot this whole thing. I was talking about buses going to Washington for the big anti-war demonstration this Saturday, January 27th. There's some buses apparently available from Ann Arbor, not from Detroit, but if you've never been to something like this, now is the time to go.
Oh, absolutely.
We did talk about this, how last week,
sure.
Yeah, just about how stirring involvement.
Well, it's life-changing, especially if you've never done it before. It is something that, it will change your life, and it will change you fundamentally forever.
Now, it's 500 miles away, which means when I drive there, I can drive there close to 8 hours and 45 minutes, 9 hours to get there. And the buses go all night, Friday night, March, Saturday, and then go back and go most of the night during Saturday. But if you're driving, you're going to find it tough to find a place. You're certainly not going to find any place in Washington because there's going to be hundreds of thousands of people there for this.
Yeah, you have to park somewhere and then you take the tube or whatever they call it there. Yeah.
And so if you want to stay overnight, you better get on the Internet and get someplace in Virginia or Maryland or
someplace like that. Yeah, right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of a couple of the... I have friends who live in the Baltimore area, so...
Baltimore is a little ways.
Yeah, but you can take the what is it?
There's
is
a train
it the tube?
There. Yeah, no, a tube, but there's
there?
A train.
Yeah.
I've done that. For one thing, I the march organizers, United for Peace and Justice, you can go to unitedforpeace.org. They're expecting about 300,000 people. When you see the headlines, if you see any...
They'll tell you a few thousand.
Tens of thousands marched.
Yeah.
Now, that's strictly true. I mean, so it's... 30 tens of thousands.
Why do they do that? I don't understand that.
They don't want to be seen as promoting this activity.
Poor people.
They can report everything that Bush and the rest of these liars say without putting forth any contradictory statements. Like when I used to write for the Metro Times here in Detroit, I try to write, be frank, sort of like an advocacy position of my point of view. And you know what the city editor would say? You know, you got to go get some quotes from Detroit Edison. I was bashing like Fermi, too.
Okay.
And I just have all the anti-nuclear power people.
So they want the balance.
They want the balance. So
that's what they teach you in journalism school. That's what they taught me.
So every time, you know, they say, we're not lying. Bush said today, da-da-da-da-da. But why isn't there? Like in the run-up to the war, that there was the majority of people were against the war. Or split even, or I think the majority, like in January and February of 2003. So you would have thought that every time Bush put or Condoleezza Rice or the rest of these liars put out this crap about weapons of mass destruction and nuclear mushroom clouds. They would have said Leslie Kagan, the director of United for Peace and Justice, disputed the...
Ah!
I mean, why wouldn't they do that?
Where's the balance with the peace organizations?
Yeah.
Good question.
Or they're about a third of the Senate, all Democrats, voted against it. Why didn't they quote Carl Levin of Michigan or Debbie Stabenow of Michigan?
Good question.
They're, you know, I almost thought, did they... And I'm not asking for anybody... say yes they are. I read Frank Rich's column today in the New York Times and I thought, is there any need for me? I mean, this guy's laying it all out. His column today, the major column, one of the premier publications in the United States, the New York Times, says, lying like it's 2003. And he says, lies should not be confused with euphemisms like incompetence and denial. And remember again, I've said this before, I think since you've come back, Jolene, in 2003, we were losing stations because we called Bush a liar. Right? Remember when we had our national show?
Oh, I see what you're talking about. We lost affiliates, people who did not like our message.
Jillian and I had a national program, and we'd say, Bush is a liar. And
there's a little bit of confusion to that, too. Some people thought it was an internet show, which it was. Yeah. We had a strong internet audience, but it was through the UAW. Someone online was thinking it was the AFL-CIO, but anyhow.
Right. All right, 313-298-WRIF, there's open lines for you right now. Let's go back to our phones, and let's see, here is Matt in Clarkston. Matt, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
Peter, Jolene, both of you, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to talk about something that's at least been in the papers and media for the past week as far as Nathaniel Abraham, and I don't think any of your listeners have touched on it yet, but I wanted to make, actually, three quick points.
Wait. Before you do, Matt, are you being positive, by the way?
Yeah. Positive as far as...
Well, no. I'm sorry. I thought you were somebody else. Never mind. But, my apologies.
Okay.
I don't know who Nathaniel Abraham is.
As far as what?
As far as who he is. I mean, I could name some people, and you would say, who's that? I'm saying, who's Nathaniel Abraham?
Nathaniel Abraham was the juvenile that was convicted as an adult when he was 14 of murder. He was tried as an adult but sentenced as a juvenile, and he was just released the day before his 21st birthday last week.
This is a Michigan case?
Yes.
Okay, well, go ahead.
Okay, but anyway, I think the Detroit News was the first to report it. As far as the three points I wanted to make, initially there was an outcry that the state allegedly was paying for his apartment and supposedly college. But a few points I wanted to make, because there was a public outcry that the public was paying for his apartment and in college after he was released as a convicted murderer.
Uh-huh.
But one of the issues that I wanted to point out was I think it's about 25 degrees out right now. Initially, when he was... convicted, he was 11 years old, and if he was just to be released right now, obviously he has nowhere to go. Possibly he could go to family, but he's an adult now.
Get to the point of all this. I'm kind of losing it. So he's an 11-year-old that murdered somebody, and so there was concern that it was like a convicted murder. I don't even know if you're...
Wait, I think I remember this story now.
There was a number, I mean, throughout the country. Wasn't there some kid in Florida that...
Yes, and he's back in jail probably for good now.
Yeah, so give me the headlines on this, not the whole story.
Well, I won't give you the whole story. The headlines are that the taxpayers of the state are essentially outraged that they're going to have to pay for his rent and allegedly college. And
this is Pontiac, wasn't it?
Correct. And my point is pretty simple. It's the fact that, he was 11 years old, and now he's being released into the public. And I think at least the state owes some duty not to put him back out onto the street and give him somewhat of a head start, albeit maybe a month or two of rent.
Yeah. Well, those questions are always difficult, and particularly when they're individual ones. And when you have children, essentially, committing really heinous acts, and some people would say, 11, 12, 14 years old, they know what they're doing. I mean, an 11-year-old knows what they're doing. You know, you're not supposed to hit your little brother. Well, you're certainly not supposed to kill anybody. But what do? Do you put an 11-year-old in jail and keep him there for the rest of their lives? Or is the consequence of taking a life because you're 11, maybe, or say when you're 14, 4 or 5 years in jail for what an adult would go to jail for a lifetime for?
And
it's
you wonder what
call.
Kind of rehab is involved, and that you know, that was a good question.
Yeah, because like the kid in Florida, obviously he flunked out, right?
Oh, yeah, and he was out on the street, and then they found him with a gun like 3 months later, and then the judge gave him another break. I was living down there then, so I watched it, you know, a lot. And then he screwed up one final time. He's out of here.
All right, thank you, Matt. Thank you for raising that issue. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan, we're going to take a break, and there are some open lines for you if you'd like to be on the air talking about any of these subjects or raising new ones. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. We'll be right back.
This is WRIF.com. We'll be right back.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and joined by Jalene Jordan. We're going to do a couple shorts here, but in the meantime, there's some open lines. 313-298-WRIF, 313-9... I can't believe I can't remember this. 298-9743. One thing, Jalene, I keep forgetting. We keep talking about the big anti-war demonstration in Washington, D.C., and it's going to be this Saturday, January 27th. You can go to unitedforpeace.org. Go down there, I'm telling you.
Do it. Oh, you will not regret it.
You know, I was just about to say, I can't believe you. You got your scarf on. All of a sudden, it is cold in here.
It's a little chilly, huh?
You know, they spend $10, $12 million on this building, and it always is like super hot or super cold. But the thing that I keep forgetting is that there's going to be a support demonstration in Royal Oak at noon on Saturday at Woodward and 12 Mile Road in front of St. Joseph's Church.
Okay. Now, that I'll be able to do since I can't go to D.C.
We'll both be there?
Yes. You're not going to D.C.
No, I'm not going to D.C.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Sigrid wrote, see you in D.C. I can't go, which I won't, you know, actually, I don't want to start on the reason I decided not to go at the last moment, we thought our dog was having another bad deal.
Oh, no.
But it turned out not to be.
Oh, phew.
But in the meantime, your doggies are okay?
I have a doggie that's going in for a little surgery this week, a little teeth cleaning. It'll be just fine.
Well, let's see.
Not that anyone cares. We call this, as Drew and Mike call it, radio for two.
Yes, right. Here, Bree writes in, Dennis Kucinich, the Democratic congressman from the Cleveland area, who was the mayor of Cleveland at one time, has a plan to get the troops out of Iraq, and it's a good one. This is the length of the plan on getting out of Iraq. I think it's a good one. Please let Republicans who demand an alternative know about this. You can go to Kucinich.us, and you can find it there. Also, is the Jalene Jordan CD available at any local independent record stores?
You know, that's a really good question. No, it's not.
Really?
And I need to actually – I've never gone and talked to any of these, you know – local store owners. I just haven't. But JaleneJordan.com.
Well, how about this? He says, can't access the site, and I just access it, and you get one big lime green square, nothing else.
Really?
Yeah, that'll ruin your night, huh?
Has someone hacked me?
I don't know.
You can also go to CDBaby.com.
CDBaby.com.
And you can buy it through that.
All right.
Thank you for asking.
Yeah, so you check out your web mistress. And say, what is the deal? So what's happening with Robert Redford? It is all of a sudden, it's freezing in here.
I'm telling you, my nose is cold. But Sundance, you know, the annual film festival, it opened Thursday night. And Robert Redford, who is way cool, he said to a packed audience for the opening night, he said, we put all our concerns on hold to let the leaders lead. I think we're owed a big, massive apology. And he's talking about the war.
Yeah. What did I have? Oh, yeah. Despite NATO, Afghan opium cultivation grows by 61%.
Oh, go figure. I mean, they were back at it within a month of our invasion over there.
61% has gone up this year. Setback for U.S. and NATO efforts. Of course, it's our buddies, the Northern Alliance and Karzai's friends, who are involved in all this poppy production and opium creation, manufacture, that the Taliban, who had wiped it out, absolutely wiped it. Two southern Afghan provinces, Helmand and Oruzgan, maybe, where the Taliban had been the most active, are responsible for the bulk of increase. Poppy planting there was up 132% from last year.
Wow.
Well, all right.
And the Taliban are still there.
Yeah, they are.
Looks like you have a bunch of phone calls.
Okay, I won't read this insane email, which I actually love, but all right. Here's Pat about Nathaniel Abraham. Pat, where are you calling from? It's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air.
Detroit.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay, my comment, first of all, good morning to you guys.
Hey, hi.
Good morning.
My comment is about the young man that was released from prison, Nathaniel.
Uh-huh.
I agree with the last phone caller in that we should not have to send this kid. Well, pay for his apartment and pay for his education. My opinion is because, I don't know if you guys saw him on the news when he was released, he had on a bright white pinstripe suit which was like maybe $500 or $600. A rabbit coat, all the things he had on were expensive. And my question is, if he's got that kind of money, and or his people have got that kind of money, can't they help pay for his education and his apartment?
You would think so. I mean, he came out of out of prison wearing a rabbit skin coat.
Oh, yes. Oh, it was all over the news. Matter of fact, Carmen Harlan, well, everybody on Channel 4 were asking people to call in and give their comments whether or not he was dressed appropriately. Which he was
how
not.
Did I miss this?
Oh, I don't know how you guys did, but he looked like he walked out of a Players Club.
Right, yeah. No, a night on the town.
Yes, imagine a white pinstripe or cream-colored pinstripe suit. And a fuchsia colored shoes, shirt, white hat with a fuchsia band, and a black rabbit coat.
Dress for success or dress for crime.
It was awful because I really got upset about it because they were asking him his plans for the future and why was it so hard for him to apologize to the family of the young man that he killed.
Yeah.
He arrogantly flexed himself several times on his shoulders and said, well, I'll let my work speak for me. What does that mean? You let your work. What work? He hasn't worked anywhere.
Yeah, I know. Well, maybe making license plates or something like that.
It'll be interesting to see how he turns out.
Well,
it was very upsetting. You know, it was like he was saying to everybody, I did it, I got away with it, and so what?
Now, well, I mean, did spend 10 years in prison, but a life has been taken, and you would think that he would be humbled by the experience. It doesn't look like that. Doesn't sound like he's off on the right track, given what you said. All right, Pat, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, for filling us in. I missed that whole thing.
Here's Frank in Ann Arbor. Frank, it's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Jolene. Great show.
Thank you.
First off, this guy's clothes, each item can be bought for $1. I'd hate to tell you. But what I called for was they're going to be putting RFIDs and money, and they're going to be tracking where it goes, garage sales, wherever you go, the whole loop of where your money goes. So that's what the future's got holding for America and our money.
Yeah, well.
Tracking our cash?
Yeah, I mean, putting chips in essentially little sensors in our money. I've heard that before.
Where are we moving? Where are we moving today?
Yeah. I remember I saw a cartoon a long time ago, Frank, that there was like, you remember when plane hijacking was a big thing?
Yeah.
And this guy, this guy's got a gun on the pilot, and the pilot's saying, take you to a free country. He said, this is a jumbo jet, not a spaceship, mate. Thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. Let's see. Here's Jack in Sterling Heights. I think he's got more bad news about Nathaniel Abraham. What's up, Jack?
Yes, how you doing there, Peter?
Doing well.
I like your show now that you got a new sidekick. I hope you keep her around, you know, for a long time.
She's my partner. She's my partner, not my sidekick.
Well, everybody's got to have a sidekick. Carson had one. And she's good. I like her. I like the input between the two of you. It's really fantastic. Now I look forward to your show every week. I always did before, but now I really look forward to it.
I'm her sidekick.
But, you're very sweet. Thank you.
But the thing I want to tell you about Nathaniel is he just signed, in prison he signed. It's amazing how they can do these things. Hollywood has signed him to a big book deal and a possible movie. So he's going to come out dressed very, very, very fancy.
Wow.
If you look it up.
And not just a dollar.
Oh, not a dollar, no.
But, Jack, I thought there were these laws that prohibited people from benefiting in that manner from crimes they committed.
Sure, there's laws, but like you know and I know, laws are made to be pushed aside for certain people.
Well, I can't imagine a guy that gets out of prison after murdering somebody, spending 10 years in jail, they're not going to waive it for him. They waive it for the big shots, but...
OJ.
Yeah. All right, Jack, thank you. Appreciate it. And... glad you're looking forward to the show, even though it's not because of me. Here is Adam in Westland. Adam, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. How's it going?
Going great.
The ethics laws that had just been passed
in Congress
right.
for the limitations on lobbyists. Do you think that's going to make a positive impact on policymakers?
Well, I don't know. You know, it used to be that it was a crime to try to influence a legislation at all, up until, I mean, during the 19th century, maybe even into the 20th century. In other words, if you tried to lobby a legislator on behalf of fill-in-the-blank, whoever, you were guilty of a crime. Now, it's just been taken for granted that they're going to be greasing people's palms. Actually, the Democrats, although I don't think this legislation, most of it, is quite as dramatic as it's made out to be, or they make it out to be, it still has kind of altered the atmosphere, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean,
I just hope that it's actually going to have a positive impact, because there's also lobbyists that go for, you know, environmental things as well.
Sure.
And I hope it doesn't affect them as much as it does the people that are out for their own benefit.
Absolutely.
Yeah, tobacco and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, there are union lobbyists and civil liberties lobbyists. I don't know if civil liberties lobbyists, but they are so outweighed by the people that are just trying to loot the American people further that you're right. All right, thanks a lot.
And a lot of loopholes. There's always loopholes.
Yes. Let's go up to Diane. We were talking about Dick DeVos earlier from the home of Dick DeVos, Grand Rapids. Here's Diane. Hey, Diane, you're on the air.
Hi, I'd rather not be referred to as from the home of Dick DeVos.
I know. I somehow knew it. I know.
And I really do want to echo what the guy before the last one said. It's really nice hearing a guy and a gal talking together. It kind of balances the energy out.
Sure.
Well,
in my Tai Chi, I learn about yin and yang.
Oh, you know everything.
And I'm too young! Never mind. Go ahead.
Well, I wanted to tell you that actually I wanted to thank you for emailing our West Michigan Peace and Justice Coalition about the action at Carl Levin's office around the state, because we did send a contingent down to speak to Carl Levin on Friday, and we had a vigil, a little noon vigil outside the federal building, and his staff listened to our concerns about defunding the war, and so we were part of that statewide action.
Well, that's good. Let me just fill people in. You did pretty well, but on Friday there were calls for demonstrations at the offices around Michigan. I guess I have to say I sort of initiated it on my own.
You did?
I did. I got a hold of all these peace groups around the state and suggested that there be simultaneous demonstrations or vigils or rallies.
Actions, as she
said.
Actions
at Carl Levin's 7 offices. I don't know how many there were. I know Detroit and Grand Rapids for sure. And with the idea of saying, hey, Carl, we need a little bit more. You're the chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee. We need a little bit more than just sort of a resolution that's not binding. And we've got to start talking about defunding this war. It's the only way they're going to stop this madman in the White House. Right,
okay. Diane? Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Right.
Well, I sent another email today, including to, I don't want to say his last name, but to Mark, isn't that his name?
That's correct.
Yeah, to Mark, urging people to do similar to what's being done in the Detroit area, to have these vigils or rallies or whatever next Saturday on January 27th in support of our neighbors and community members that are going off to Washington to protest the war on Saturday.
Yes, and we are going to have one. We're having one at noon at Fulton and Division, which is the direct center of Grand Rapids. We actually had talked about it before your email, but we didn't know about the Levin's office, and it was great. Cause when I was sitting in the meeting, Mark said, I got an email from someone named Peter Werby, and I said, I've been listening to him for years.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so good for you.
Well, there is, and how I found his or your group's address, there is, I can't think of what you call it, like a coalition, but it's not in good enough contact. We're all not in good enough contact with one another, and I was talking to somebody from Ann Arbor who works on that, and we're going to try to make sure that everybody knows what's happening, because I repeatedly run into people that say to me, what's going on? Oh, you know, in fact,
a lot of it usually can be found on your website at peterwerby.com, P-E-T-E-R, WERBE. How's that?
Yeah, Diane, in fact, thank you.
You're welcome.
Jeremy from Livonia wrote in to me, do you know where I can find any information on protests around our area? And I said, yeah, go to my website calendar. I put it there. And if you're having events in the area, send them on to me as well.
Well, we'll have to do that. But there is a Michigan Peace Network that's getting everything up, and we've got new software that we're using, and we're all trying to stay in contact. And I understand there's a bus going to the big one from Lansing and Kalamazoo, as well as Ann Arbor, but I'm not sure. But
and a couple from the Detroit area, and usually from
definitely Lansing. I saw that one.
And,
yeah.
And usually from Traverse City as well.
Yeah, usually you know they find some way to hook up.
Yeah.
But those are really the four regions that everyone should try to you know find that bigger city around them. But we're really trying to get organized, and you've done a great job in motivating people. And we were down. Said, hey, Peter's called it, and we're going to go out and do it.
Hey, me a great leader. I can't imagine it. All right, Diane,
when the verb speaks, the people act. Something like that.
All right, peace out. Thank you, Diane.
Bye.
Bye-bye now. Yeah, right.
Good job, though. Really.
Yeah, well, good. I mean, it's funny that I... well, never mind. This kind of movement biz.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. So, take part in these actions. You know... I talked, it was on Thursday at Wayne State University. There was a sort of a history of activity at Wayne State. And I said that I think there's a moral imperative, an ethical imperative to be part of making this country better, of bringing peace and social justice to it. But it's also the best way to live, I think.
Oh, absolutely.
You meet the most interesting people.
You sure do.
Yeah.
And, you know, quality of life is all, I guess, relevant. And if you think your quality of life is improved by, you know, having the pool in the backyard or whatever it is, you know, the Porsche in the driveway, I personally think a quality of life is attending things like this. And
not like a Porsche in the driveway.
No, you wouldn't,
no,
Peter.
I would. Listen. Let me, I don't mean to insult any Porsche owners or people with...
no, they're nice cars. Don't get me wrong. Maybe I'm just jealous. Okay?
I was thinking... Well, I don't know. You know, we'll talk about this some other time. We should get these last callers real quickly because we have to close up real soon. Here's Dan and Inkster. Dan, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing tonight, Peter?
Doing well.
Hey, I just had a little comment about the Nathaniel issue, too. You know, it's just real sad, you know, that he comes walking out looking like a pimp.
That's what I didn't want to say.
Money.
I didn't want to say the four-letter word, but that's what it sounded like.
It's kind of harsh, but it is. It's the truth. It's as bad as when the rapper Proof and the military guy got into it at the nightclub, and they got a big billboard on 94. I get sick to my stomach seeing it every morning going to work.
Yeah.
I just thought,
Eminem's company did
that. When, you know, here we got a guy that serves our country, and, you know, he died for no reason. No just cause there. And we got a kid. 10 years old, he shoots someone for no just cause, and they're going to go and praise him, and they're going to drape him and gold like he's a king, and it's totally unacceptable today. Michigan's broke, and if he's got that much money in the family, they should give it to the family of the son that lost his life.
Yeah, well, like I said, I can't believe that he's going to be allowed to reap any proceeds from a book or a movie or anything like that. I'm sort of surprised at the first caller, because like I said, I knew nothing about this whatsoever. But normally I would say if someone can be helped, sure, the community should do that. But, I mean, this sounds nuts. All right, Dan, thank you very much. Here is Chris in Monroe. Chris, hi, you're on the air. What I always say, the home of General George Custer and Fermi 2. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah.
How you doing, Peter? Have a good night. Hey, I just want to touch on a quick subject here that's been, started since Clinton and Obama have decided to run for presidency. And that is the spin on Obama's Muslim background from his bringing up as a child into now the political scene.
You know what his middle name is, don't you?
I have not heard that.
This is for real. Hussein.
Right.
The American public, I mean, the idea that they would elect an African-American is a little beyond my ability to...
Or a woman.
Or, well,
I don't know.
And now we have a first Afro-American going to the Super Bowl.
Yeah, manager.
Coach.
Yeah.
The two coaches.
Coach.
Yeah. Two
coaches, exactly.
Right.
They're both African-American?
Yes.
Yes.
Wow.
I can't believe that I knew that, but I did.
Yeah, well, the Colts.
They're making a big deal
Colts
out
took
it.
Hey, 38-34.
That's right.
Yeah. Good job, Peter.
Yeah. All right.
Look at us.
Am I reading anything?
No.
All right, so I know this stuff.
Well, it'd be interesting to follow, you know, what gets dug up on this topic here for next year or two, and then the 4 years after that, if there's an election of his.
It's interesting that Obama already, you know, right out of the chute, said that he had used cocaine. I don't think that that messes with people's minds as much as it used to.
Well, today's drug enforcement in their hands, and it probably has made it a little better for the public to use.
All right. Thank you, Chris. Thanks for being our last caller. And, Jalene, thank you. And
thank
so
you, Peter.
Got an hour of interviews. And if I go real quickly to my site, yes, it is Jim Motovalli, the editor of E! The Environmental Magazine. He's going to be talking about the auto show. And then Heather Vokish, who has written the Progressive's Handbook. Get the facts and make a difference now. That's a good note to go on.
I'd like to get that.
Go to Washington or join us in Royal Oak at noon on Saturday. Say no to Bush's war.
This is WRIM.com.
Mama, you got to move. I will talk to you later. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Pleasure to be with you. So many things going on today and in our world. And how do we sort through them all? I have a number of sources that I like to look at in order to try to sort everything out, make some sense of things. And I know all of you try to do the same as well. Joining me is Heather Vokush. Heather Vokush is the author of The Progressive's Handbook, Get the Facts and Make a Difference Now, Volumes 1 and 2. And in fact, you can go to the website progressiveshandbook.com, find out more information about that. I'll give you the information again, though, later in our program. Joining me from Vienna, Austria, Heather Vokush. Heather, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Well, thank you very much for having me on.
What are you doing so far away from home? Or is Austria home?
Actually, I'm transatlantic. I spend part of my time here and also part of my time back in the States. I should mention my husband is actually Austrian.
Okay. And the work that you do, the kind of social criticism, social analysis, your Progressive's Handbook, do you think traveling to Europe gives you a better sense of what's going on here?
Well, that's an interesting question, Peter. Actually, you know, I've lived a lot of my life in other countries in addition to the United States. I spent 12 years in Tokyo, for example. And what I have found is that really we are so much more similar than we think. And it's also very, very interesting to see what people in other countries think about what is going on in the United States. And so I think it just adds a new dimension to the whole perspective, I would say.
Well, Chris Hedges, when I interviewed him, we were talking about patriotism, and he said that patriotism essentially are the stories that we tell ourselves about ourselves, and of course they're always good ones, and I think oftentimes that we're shocked when we hear that other people don't think the world of us as we frequently think of ourselves.
Well, that's a really good point. Yeah, and for me it's been interesting as somebody who has lived abroad and then gone back to the States and back and forth. It's been really interesting, I would say, over the past certainly 10 years and certainly under Bush, how people's reactions have changed. You know, usually they'll say, okay, well, we love the American people, but we just can't stand the people who are in the government right now. However, what I've really found is things have just gotten so bad and so egregious, and Bush's popularity is just so low that sometimes people are kind of crossing that line and saying, well, you know, the United States is just kind of a write-off. And that, for me, is terrifying, even when our allies, even when friends are stating things like that. And I think part of it is because they say, well, I mean, my goodness, you elected these people. And I keep explaining, actually, no, we didn't. But then, you know, it gets quite complicated. So, yeah, not so good.
Well, in November of 2006, there was a sea change, certainly in the Congress, and not at all in the White House. But has that changed any opinions, like, for instance, in Austria where you are?
Actually, you know, they are completely engrossed in their own electoral issues right now, and so they've been mainly focusing on that. For me, actually, regarding this sea change, this is just a personal opinion, but this kind of terrifies me, actually, because I think that the Republicans basically can pull a lot more tricks in 2008. They kind of hid them in 2006, and I don't see the Democrats as addressing that. I'm worried that they'll get complacent and not pursue, you know, things like electoral integrity and what have you. And so on a personal level, 2006 was more of a concern than anything. But as far as people over here, I think they mainly are focusing on, oh my goodness, what's going on in Iraq? Oh my goodness, what's going on in Iran? And this is their main focus right now.
Well, Heather Vokush, I don't know if you were alluding to the fact that there are many people that say that both the 2000 and 2004 elections were stolen through electoral shenanigans, mostly through the voting, the electronic voting machines. But I know Greg Palast, when I spoke with him, said they're going to do it again. But the thing that has to happen is the majority has to be so great that that the tampering won't change the outcome, which we'll see. We'll see what the Democrats can do in the next 2 years. We'll see what's going to happen in areas like Iraq.
Yeah, that's a good point. But also, for example, in relation to Palast, I mean, he's been at the forefront of looking at how our system, our electoral system, just completely disenfranchises, for example, you know, people of color and what have you. And I don't see the Democrats addressing that. And this loses you know, upwards of a million votes per year, per election, pardon me. And so, and then you add the dirty tricks that took place even in 2006, his robocall and the campaign and what have you. And I really believe that we will be at a loss if we don't address this really effectively starting now.
I never did get the Democrats. I mean, they get slapped around every dirty trick in the books, and then they say, well, we got to be nice.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't even have to be not nice. All you have to do is demand, as you said, the integrity of the electoral system as being a key to overcoming the kind of cynicism that people feel about elections. I mean, we were all excited because 40% of Americans actually got out to vote in 2006.
Yeah, but, and you know, what was interesting for me is before 2006, as you might recall, this October Gallup poll showed that only 28% of Americans felt, quote, very confident that their vote casting and counting would be done accurately. Yeah, I mean, 3 out of 4 Americans doubt the integrity of their own electoral system. And you know, they're right. They should.
Yeah.
And that clearly is something that we need to be addressing. Our democracy is only as strong as our voting system. And I, yeah, again, I mean, I can go off for hours on this, but as you had mentioned, for example, the Democrats not being very aggressive in counteracting, you know, the Republican games. I mean, this is in the elections. This, of course, now is going on regarding Iraq. I mean, this is pretty much across the board.
Yeah, there's something missing in our Iraq strategy, and that's the compliance of our puppet. The Maliki government that doesn't seem to really be on board with what are they calling it now? The what forward? They have some little phrase they stole from Ford Motor. I can't remember the next something or other forward. I mean, it's one of those things where these phrases get pumped up and then they disappear as quickly as they've arisen. But let me tell people that one of the things that they can do is go to your website, Heather Vokush, and it's spelled Vokoush, and .com, and also progressiveshandbook.com as well. I can't imagine that you're one of the few people on the planet that think the latest Bush strategy will have any effect other than more blood and destruction. Any sense of why he would propose this? It seems like an impossibility.
Oh, actually, I could go up for hours.
Go for a few minutes at least.
But actually, may I first make a minor correction? Actually, my last name is actually rather hard to spell and pronounce. So the website is Heather, and then Vokush.com. So there's only one O in there. So regarding your question,
did I say two?
You said OU. Yeah, which is, you know, a lot of people do that, actually, but it's just USCH.com.
Okay.
But anyway, in relation to your question, I found both Bush's speech and also his 60 Minutes interview to be just extraordinary. You know, in the 60 Minutes interview, he called himself the educator-in-chief. And my favorite quote was when he said, and this is a quote, "I think the Iraqi people owe the American people a debt of gratitude, you know, so that we, you know, thank us for having invaded your country." Meanwhile, on, you know, right around the same time, you got 109 people died just on Tuesday, yesterday. You got over 34,000 civilians who have been killed in 06, and so it's just a disaster. Now, back to your question regarding, do they actually think this will work, or does anybody think this will work? Well, it really depends on how you define success. That's the interesting issue. As came out last week, you know, the Independent reported that the Iraqi parliament is right now ready to look at these things called these production sharing agreements, or PSAs, which essentially are going to hand Iraq's oil over to foreign oil companies. And if you look at it from that perspective, well, you know, the invasion has been successful. I guess you could look at it that way. And from another perspective, is once we actually have peace not only in Iraq, but in other areas in the world, then Bush can't really play the tough guy anymore. Because when you've got this tough guy, you know, then you don't need diplomacy and nurturance and things like that. And so essentially the Bush administration's focus benefits from having constant chaos and constant war. The interesting thing for me is the recent changes that have happened, this new plan that Bush has, not only this surge of these, 21,000 soldiers, but also some of the other changes that he has made in his, not only his legal team, but his strategy team. It really, really looks as if they're very serious about attacking Iran. For example, you've got a naval officer with almost no experience in the Middle East, and now this guy is going to head U.S. Central Command. Well, you don't need Navy ships to deal with, you know, street fighting in Baghdad, but you do need Navy ships as far as Iran. And the issue with the Democrats, you know, everybody's saying, well, they have to restrict funding for the war. And I mean, they should have done that a long time ago. But the interesting thing, though, is that Bush aides have said, well, we've got enough funds already to get started. And it's going to take 2 months until this, you know, supplemental appropriation bill for more war funds comes up. And by that time, the troops are going to be on the ground anyway. So my fear is that the Democrats could get bamboozled into allowing this to happen, and then come 2008, they're going to be blamed for it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's what some people have said, is that Bush just wants to pass on the defeat to someone else, particularly if he could, the Democrats. But let's go back to the possibility of an attack. Let's say, I doubt if there's going to be an invasion, an attack on Iran. Now, of course, Tony Snow, I don't know when we would ever start believing you know, the press secretaries of presidents, no matter what party, but particularly egregious under the Bush administration. This is an urban myth. I mean, he misunderstands what an urban myth is, but essentially he's saying that this is just a pipe dream. And I'm forgetting his name in The New Yorker, the
Seymour Hersh,
the famous journalist who has put enough frightening evidence on the table that there is something afoot that one would think that there's a good possibility of. But I think, what in the world could they gain from this? I mean, it would seem virtually mad to attack Iran.
And Tony Snow, I mean, former Fox News guy, what are you going to expect, really?
Yeah.
But what would they gain? Again, you've got to look at who is who's playing here. Now, Bush, per se, I wouldn't dare to say that I understand what goes on inside his head, but I think basically he's just a megalomaniac, and he wants power, and he wants to destroy things. That's just kind of what he does, and so he wants to be the guy who took down both Iraq and Iran, one might add, or one might imagine. But when you think of the bigger prize for other people in Iran, for example, Israel. Israel is not comfortable with the fact that Iran potentially has this nuclear capability. But you've also got other issues. I don't know if you heard this, but Hugo Chavez and Mahmoud Ahmadinejad recently set up a fund with billions and billions of dollars to help what they said is to help poor countries escape what they described as U.S. domination. And they set this up with this big meeting and a big speech at the end of which they said, death to U.S. imperialism, you know. Yeah.
What year is this? Yeah. But but the idea of U.S. domination, corporate domination of poor nations is certainly a real phenomenon. There's no doubt about that.
Oh, clearly. But I think when you've got, for example, Chavez and Ahmadinejad going out and saying something like this, clearly this doesn't make the Bush administration and those in power very comfortable. You know, and there's also this whole thing about, you've got a proxy war going on to see who can control OPEC. You know, it always goes back to oil. Sure. Even now with this whole Somalia thing, you know, that's also about oil. The U.S. wants to safeguard access to the Red Sea for its oil tankers. And so now it's bombing, you know, countries in Africa as well. There's a crazy logic, I guess you could say, but it's ultimately going to be extremely destructive for us.
Well, I think so. And I, when I said what could they possibly hope to gain, say that, I mean, they're obviously not going to attack civilian centers, metropolises. They're not going to, like, carpet bomb Tirana. I assume they wouldn't. But what they're going to do is go after the nuclear facilities. That's going to be the excuse if that happens and one is needed. And so say they drop this enormous amount of ordnance on them. I mean, there's been talk of Israel using nuclear bunker busters. I mean, all hell is going to break loose, and this certainly will not dislodge Ahmadinejad. That, if anything, would secure his hold on power and his view of the United States and the role of Iran in the Middle East. It seems counterproductive unless, as you said, Heather Vokush, that that chaos actually works to the benefit of these people in Washington.
Well, I would say that would be my personal theory. But, you know, another issue, too, is you've got, I mean, the Sunday Times just reported that Israel has these secret plans, and people have seen them, and they want to destroy Iran's uranium enrichment facilities, blah, blah, blah. So my question is this. If, for example, Israel were to launch a strike, and there's these three main targets of these areas that they think is Iran's nuclear program, if Israel launched a strike, and then, of course, Iran would strike back, well, then what would Hillary Clinton say? What would Barack Obama say, you know, about, at that point, Israel needs to defend itself, and Israel is our ally, and eat both of them. And many Democrats have also said, well, you know, the war option has to be on the table because we need to defend Israel. And so if it were to come to a case such as that, that it isn't us attacking Iran, but rather we're only defending Israel, then that just presents a whole new dimension to this.
Well, I think your question would be easily answered. I think all of them would probably be on board with it. I mean, if we were to look at history of the uncritical support that the Democratic Party and the Republican Party give to whatever Israel does. Well, let me jump back a little and come back here to the United States and domestic policies. On your website, heathervokush.com, you have an extraordinary article called Bush and the F-Word in 2006, Police State of Progressivism in 2007. And the quote from Benito Mussolini, I think, is instructive. It says, fascism should more appropriately be called corporatism because it is a merger of state and corporate power. Well, hello. But you then make the provocative statement. It's not overstating the case to say that 2007 could make or make or break for the United States democracy. Tell me the case. I mean, I think that most people probably don't see is that this is a watershed year. How do you see it as such?
Well, I honestly do. I mean, in my very soul and in my very gut, I honestly do. One major reason is that we're really standing on the brink, from everything at least that I've seen, of a bigger, much more dramatic escalation of the crisis in the Middle East, and that would involve the United States and most likely with Iran, potentially Syria. Well, that's going to have major implications for us in the United States. But also, I mean, the United States right now is looking at a pretty severe downturn. You've got the housing market imploding. You've got the Bush administration is not going to be as eager to kind of fudge over some of the negative things going on in the economy if the Democrats will be blamed on it in 2008. And so there are just so many issues coming up right now, and they're going to come to a head, I would say, in 2007, 2008. And I really believe that people need to get focused and need to get aware and also empowered. That's my big thing. I think it's not enough just to say, oh, no, things are really nasty. Oh, no, we can see the train wreck happening. That's not enough anymore. What we need to do at this point is to say, okay, now I understand what's going on, and I'm going to do something about it. Even if it's just 10 minutes a day, man, I'm going to do something about it. I'm going to write a letter. I'm going to call into a talk radio show, what have you. And this is my really critical point, that I believe that Americans must become even more engaged in 2007.
Well, the sort of the instruction manual, if you will, is one you've authored. It's called The Progressive's Handbook. Get the Facts, very important, and Make a Difference Now, Volumes 1 and 2. So this is sort of a how-to, because I know many people listen to this broadcast, and, for instance, I'll announce a meeting or a demonstration or a town hall gathering or something like that, and I don't see very many people from this audience coming out. I don't mean to grab people by the lapels and saying, you know, come on, you got to come out. But at some point, if we don't start taking charge of our own affairs, we, the people of the United States, are going to continue to be run by this elite that do not have our best interests in mind. So what do we find in this Progressive's Handbook, and what do you think would impel people, once they've read this, to start making a difference once they've gotten the facts?
Well, that's a good question. And actually, I'll tell you why I wrote this. But probably about 2 years ago, I started getting the most this was two years ago. This was actually before the 2004 elections. I started getting the most frustrated, sad emails from readers of my opinion pieces saying, okay, it's doomed. You know, the 2004 elections are rigged and everything is doomed and there's nothing I can do. And that made me very, very scared, because when the people give up, then we've lost automatically, you know, even before the fight has taken place. And what people were saying again and again and again is, you know, things are just happening too fast, and I can't put this into some kind of logical whole. You know, I can't make sense of all these things. So what I decided to do is to write these two books, and they're kind of the alternate, the website Alternate called them part encyclopedia and part self-defense manual. It just lays out in each chapter all of the bad stuff that has happened under Bush. Well, all of the changes, like each chapter, for example, the environment chapter is 30 pages, foreign policy around 30 pages, talks about the bad stuff. But then I thought, oh my goodness, if I only describe the bad stuff, then people are going to be completely freaked out. So at the end of every chapter, I list probably 6 pages of things that you can do to make it better. And you know what? To go back to what you were saying, Peter, it's like, Not everybody actually goes to meetings, and not everybody protests or raises their voice or what have you in the same way. And a lot of people, you know, they're working 3 jobs and they don't even have time. But at the same time, I think it's really important to take even 10 minutes a day. And so what I do is list at the back of these, each chapter, little things that you can do 10 minutes a day in each of these areas, whatever you like the best, education, women's issues, what have you, so that at least you can say, okay, I made a difference today. Because I firmly believe that it's the act of taking the power that is the empowerment, you know what I mean? And the more you do it, the better it feels, and indeed the better it will be for our country.
Well, you know, ultimately, we should be talking about an ethical imperative. The world that we live in, and the world that will be inherited by generations after us, is in a miserable shape right now, and we owe something back to the world, and particularly some of us in North America. I know in where you are in Europe right now, we've gained a lot and got a lot. I mean, it's not true about everybody, but certainly a lot of us owe. But beyond that, it's taking with your word, Heather, about being empowered, that sense of not being this isolated, atomized fragment that's acted upon by advertisement and political propaganda and what have you. And you're a part of something that's reshaping your city or your neighborhood or as large as the planet. It's a pretty good feeling. And you also wind up with a lot of really decent people, don't you?
Well, that's a really good point. Yeah, you do. And you also then wind up with people who are going to ride the Democrats' posteriors and insist that they stand up and fight, you know, because right now the Democrats as a whole, or at least they have been kind of mirroring this whole, you know, passive, oh, I don't know what to do and I have no power and what have you, at least on some of the major issues that we need them to be fighting with. And so when we take our power back, then we will inspire or force, what have you, the Democrats also to take their power back. And it's, again, you know, when we're teetering on the edge of yet another invasion, and this one is going to be nuclear, and the economy is facing problems, again, I believe it. 2007 is make or break. We need to get busy here.
Is there any one thing, we just have about 30 seconds left, any one issue that if you could put out a clarion call, in fact, you can do it, to one particular issue, would it be the issue of war, or don't we want to rank order them?
Well, that's an interesting point. For me, the one interesting issue is, well, I guess two. One is people just need to inform themselves across the board and pick the topic that is the most important for the individual. Maybe for that person it's education, maybe it's the environment, what have you. And so personalize it. Pick the issue that means the most to you, look into what has gone on, and then take it personally. With these rollbacks, take it personally and then fight back. This is what I would say.
All right. And also, get the book, The Progressive's Handbook. Get the Facts and Make a Difference Now is the subtitle, Volumes 1 and 2. You can go to progressiveshandbook.com. I will have a link to it as well on my site, peterwerby.com. And I assume that links to your personal site as well, right, Heather?
Yeah, it sure does. And you know what I would like to invite your listeners to do regardless is on that site I've got something called an action center. And it's got all of these interesting things that you can do, you know, great quotes and inspiring people and what have you. And so if you're just feeling kind of bummed and about the political process, you know, go visit it and also send in your ideas. And so it's kind of meant to really inspire people to get active. So if you're feeling bummed about the political thing, please come visit my site.
Well, thank you so much, Heather Vokush, who called us from Vienna, Austria. Thanks, and appreciate you being on the Peter Werby Show.
Well, thank you so much, Peter.
Weekday nights at 10 with Meltdown. It's like getting hit in the head by a 2x4 with a nail in it. Mandatory Metallica. Now, it's your triple play of the mighty Metallica with a big unit. Every weekday night at 10, exclusively from your one and only Metallica station. 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Thank you.
Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Man, finally got cold in Detroit, hasn't it? Winter is upon us. We thought we were really experiencing the results of global warming. At the same time, the Detroit Auto Show, the International Automobile Show in Detroit, is happening as we speak. Joining me is Jim Motovalli. And Jim Motovalli is a well-known figure in the environmental movement, and he is the editor of E! Magazine, E! The Environmental Magazine. You can go to emagazine.com. Jim Motovalli has joined me any number of times for some of the books he has written. He's a regular contributor to the New York Times, and we're talking with him at his magazine headquarters in Connecticut, right?
Right.
Right.
Where it's just as cold.
It's just as cold. Welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Great to be on.
We spoke, I know, before about your magazine, and remind me, I should have that in front of me, the book we talked about last, probably.
Probably Green Living, the E-Magazine Handbook for Living Lightly on the Earth.
And we did, and you did, actually, you did a book about automobiles, too, right?
Right. I wrote a book called Forward Drive, The Race to Build Clean Cars for the Future, which Sierra Club Books published. And it's still fairly, believe it or not, it came out in 2000, but it's still pretty much where we're at. Things haven't changed. We're still waiting for fuel cell cars, and I predicted that hybrids would be a big deal, so I was right there.
Well, good. I thought sometimes people scare me. They say, yeah, I think it was 1987, so good. It's only 7 years ago that we talked about that book. Well, that makes some sense to maybe reexamine that in terms of the Detroit Auto Show. I know the Rainforest Action Network people who I interviewed last week were here trying to, use gentle persuasion upon the car companies to bring about some of the advancements that are possible in automobile transportation to get us off of oil. You didn't make it to the auto show, but any observations from afar, Jim Motovalli?
I think what they do is valuable. If they want to prod the car industry to actually live up to some of its green rhetoric, and the industry loves to take advantage and take credit for the green initiatives it proposes. And the dirty secret, of course, is it makes all its money, at least if we're talking about Detroit, from SUVs and pickup trucks, the least fuel efficient in its line. The thing is, though, that that has begun to change, and especially since $3 a gallon gasoline, consumers have started to look for smaller cars, and Detroit has found it hard to just sort of switch on a dime and get competitive in producing smaller cars. There's a reason that Toyota is rapidly gaining on all the car makers and now in second place behind General Motors, because they're very good at building cars across the whole spectrum, including very, very competitive Econo boxes. And this is an area that Detroit's had a lot of problem. But having said all that, I still think it's important to acknowledge some of the things the car industry has done right. And if you're going to protest the industry, I don't see why they protested at a press conference where Chevrolet was announcing its new Volt car, which is the greenest thing to come out of Detroit in a long time. So I personally would not have chosen to disrupt that particular press conference, but that's what the groups did.
Well, I just worry that it's all too little, too late. I mean, as it is, it seems like sort of the operational request is, please, sir, don't kill everything so soon. I mean, if we are at a crisis point in global warming and wars for oil and scarcity coming upon us, peak oil point being reached, if it hasn't been reached already, these little hopes that Chevrolet will get out of production model Volt doesn't really speak to the issue.
Well, I think it does, because cumulatively we have to have 1,000 volts, if you look at it that way.
There you go.
Many volts. We need announcements of a lot of cars like that, because I think consumers are in a place where if you offer them something that gets the equivalent of 100 miles per gallon, and I think the Volt is in that territory, they're going to like pay attention to that. Nobody likes paying $3 a gallon for gasoline. The prices have been creeping up again. I find it amazingly Pavlovian of American consumers, though, that as soon as gas prices go down just a little bit, people go back to thinking that they can go out and buy a Hummer or something like that.
Well, Jim, actually, gas now. I just went by my local Citgo station, and there was $1.89, and fuel prices have dropped. The barrel prices down to 51. Here's Chavez and Ahmadinejad saying that they got to get OPEC to produce less because prices are dropping.
Well, that's interesting because it's still very high here.
Really?
I'm in Connecticut, and we're still got $2.50, $2.60 a gallon gasoline.
Wow. Well, yeah.
And we haven't seen the low prices yet.
Yeah, well, it's like the weather blows from west to east. So hopefully, well, that was one of my predictions that after the election, the gas prices would go back up. But they sure haven't here. But in any event, I agree with you that that as soon as these prices drop a little, let alone a lot, people go, oh yeah, I love my big F-150 or whatever. And there's so much more to it. I mean, it's not just serviceability or what's the word I'm looking for, efficiency or practical use of an automobile. It's a lot of its image, and that's why, like, the Detroit Auto Show is more exciting than, for instance, if it was a refrigerator show. I mean, refrigerator shows, you want to get a nice refrigerator, you want it to look kind of nice, but mostly it's what it's going to do. But our cars are also, in many ways, speak about who we are.
Right, because the SUV is fundamentally an irrational product. For 99% of the people who buy it, it doesn't make any sense. And the only way it would make sense is if you thought about image. Like the demonizing of the minivan in favor of the SUV. I get this from my own kids who think a Hummer is cool and a minivan, it wouldn't be caught dead in it. Well, a minivan is a much more efficient way to move people and things around than an SUV. But we're not dealing with rationality.
No, and to be sure, like when I was a kid, the last thing in the world you wanted was a four-door. I mean, the coolest thing, right, was a two-door hardtop or a convertible.
Right, of course.
Or the coolest of all, a convertible. But I think it's difficult for the average person, even though over here they know that global warming is real. They can see these ice shelves beginning to break off. They can see Greenland actually becoming green. Temperatures rising. And
we're discovering islands we didn't know existed in Greenland because of the underneath the snow and ice. It turns out there was islands instead of
connected
solid land.
Yeah, but then I want to buy a car and I want something that gets me from here to there, but I'd like to kind of look cool. I'd like to kind of look like a macho guy. You know, there's a little difference. You pull up in a 150 or you pull up in a Prius. I mean, you're saying something each time, you know, that the automobile announces in many ways who you'd like your persona to represent.
But if everyone's buying SUVs, doesn't buying an SUV show you to be a conformist more than buying a minivan? I don't understand that, really.
Well, I know. I mean, mass psychology, hey, I don't know about that. My guest is Jim Motovalli, and he's the editor of E! Magazine. You can go to emagazine.com. There'll be a link on my site as well. It's a bimonthly magazine, and I have in front of me the January-February edition of E! The Environmental Magazine, an extraordinarily interesting issue. It's centering on building greener. An eco-revolution is transforming our approach to design and construction from home and office to entire communities. So is this too little, too late, or is this a leading edge of hopefully a different manner in which we're going to construct things?
Well, first let me just say, if you want to get E's take on the whole clean car thing, our March-April issue is going to be devoted to that.
Oh, that's good. That's good to know.
When it comes to building, I think there's a lot of parallels with what's happening with the car industry, that there are some very nice show place green homes, the same way there are some very nice show place green cars, but they represent a tiny fraction of the whole. For every beautiful LEED certified green building that's built, 1,000 are built the same way we've always built them.
Well, how are they different? I mean, I always thought, gee, couldn't they just insist that homes have solar panels on their roofs, for instance, by code, and have solar accumulators, in our home?
Well, they could do a number of things, and there are some, a growing number, and it's very embryonic still, but some communities actually do require you to make green renovations, say, when you sell your house. This is true in Burlington, Vermont, and Berkeley, California. They have a set of green standards, and when you sell your house, you're required to, say, spend 1% of the purchase price or 0.3%, whatever it is, on green improvements designed to get you closer to meeting that code.
Like what, for instance?
Well, one would be installing new windows so your house was more airtight, maybe putting in compact fluorescent bulbs, solar panel or something like that, something that made your house more efficient.
Now, a big fear of my wife, who has many of them about what the future holds for us all, is what happened here in Detroit the other day. A number of us lost power. We didn't, actually, but a number of people in the Detroit area because of these ice storms. So, of course, when your electricity goes, if you have forced air, as we do, maybe your furnace is heating up, but it's nothing to blow it into the house. So you're essentially, electricity goes, and you're kind of in bad shape. What is there? Are there alternatives that that we could imagine in older houses? Like my house is about 60 years old or something like that, that could be retrofitted that would make us prepare us for being off the grid in an unintended manner?
Well, you've actually hit upon the major market right now for fuel cells.
Okay.
There is a existing commercial market for fuel cells, which are being bought by hospitals and other organizations that really can't have power outages. So they go to backup power, and that's an ideal use right now for fuel cells. So you have a fuel cell in the basement, and it can start generating electricity very quickly. And these are very large industrial fuel cell installations, and many hospitals have them now.
And what are they exactly like, or what are they fuel cells? I mean, we hear that all the time. What exactly are they? Where does the energy come from?
It comes from hydrogen. You would have a supply of hydrogen, and from the hydrogen it produces basically waste, water, and electricity.
Huh. And is it available for residential situations?
Well, for residential use, it really has not been effective because it's not cost effective, because these systems produce electricity that's more costly than the grid. So the only way you'd want to use that is if you were off the grid. If you were somewhere that's out of reach of power lines, you definitely could use a fuel cell to generate electricity the same way you can use solar panels. But the idea, actually, General Electric had a partnership with a company called Plug Power, which was designed to take your house off the grid and use the existing natural gas line that was in your house. So the natural gas would come in, and the fuel cell would chemically separate hydrogen from the natural gas. The hydrogen would be used to produce electricity, and your house would be off the grid. That would work as long as you can do that process at a cost that's lower than the grid, but we don't really have that yet.
Are we really going to be able to have an impact of the type that both you and I see as a necessity without a larger social commitment to that? I mean, as long as we have an administration that, we hear that Bush is addressing global warming in his State of the Union speech, but that heretofore has denied that it even was a problem, and more catastrophes happening, without a major social commitment to it, do these things that you do and that I do and that E! Magazine proposes and some people are doing, is it more than a gesture?
It's more or less a gesture now. You could say that. Certainly on the federal government level, we haven't even made the gesture. And I think anyone who's serious about global warming has written off Bush or anything that he might choose to do at this point. However, the heartening thing is that on the state level and on the municipal level, lots of things are happening. The mayor of Seattle, Washington, Greg Nickels, has led this initiative whereby mayors and first electmen all around the United States have signed on and said that they will personally, in their cities, initiate the Kyoto Accords. Now, actually saying that and then actually doing that are a little bit hard. I think Portland, Oregon is the closest to actually meeting Kyoto, and its latest data shows that it's about 1% above 1990 levels in terms of the emissions it's producing. So it's not yet meeting Kyoto. But then most of the countries that have signed Kyoto aren't meeting Kyoto either.
Well, which in a way brings us back to automobiles and what they produce. I was reading an article in the New York Times the other week about traffic congestion in Dublin, Ireland, which has had like a fourfold expansion in personal automobile use. And the article was saying that what has been reduced in factory pollution over the years has been more than made up for with automobile exhaust and emissions, even with all the emission controls. And you have the situation where China suddenly is expanding as a market for internal combustion engines, both cars and motorcycles and scooters. India, I don't know. I mean, can the world survive with internal combustion, oil-based product fuel cars and motorcycles?
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
And we cannot do, and you just very succinctly added up the problem we face. Countries like China are adding millions of cars to the world roads every year. India is also getting very much into private cars. They've opened up to an international auto market. Europe is expanding the number of cars. The United States is hardly cutting back on auto traffic, and vehicle miles traveled grow every year. So if you take that, if you take the challenge we have from global warming, add in the challenge of peak oil, which is very much related to it, and you alluded to that earlier, you have an absolutely untenable situation, which basically means we have to find an alternative to fossil fuels. We will not be able to continue burning coal in power plants. We will not be able to have as many gasoline engine cars on the road. There's just no way that the present formula works for any sort of future outlook for the world. So the problem is we don't have any very easily accessible replacement for fossil fuel right now. We have a number of small-scale possible alternatives. Hydrogen is on the horizon. Biofuels are gradually taking up some of the slack. The battery electric car is beginning to show a little bit of promise. Technology like the Chevrolet Volt, I think, is very innovative. That doesn't get us totally out of internal combustion. Basically, what the Volt does is it has a gasoline engine that is just used to keep batteries charged. And it solves the range problem that we currently have with battery cars. And you may remember that GM brought out the EV1 battery car.
Sure.
But only 600 or 700 of them were leased. And the main problem was their lack of range. They'd only go about 90 miles. So with a thing like the Volt, or with a hybrid, just a general hybrid car, you solve that problem by combining a small gas engine and an electric motor, and then you've got the range thing licked. Mm-hmm. We may come up with some really great batteries. I think that would be wonderful. I think lithium-ion batteries are pretty good. And I think Detroit has finally woken up to the possibilities of batteries. And that's why you're beginning to see battery technology in concept cars, as well as fuel cells in concept cars. But a lot of those concepts you're seeing on the stage in Detroit, underneath the skin, they're not really ready for prime time.
Well, and
technology isn't worked out.
And we're fortunate here in the Detroit area to have the genius of Stan and Iris Ovshinsky, who are featured in the movie about what's the name of the car again? The EV1. The EV1,
yes. They're also in my book, Forward Drive. I went and visited them in 1999.
Well, the amazing story of all this is Who Killed the Electric Car, that features Stan and Iris Ovshinsky in it. Is an extraordinary story, particularly how General Motors wanted to gobble them all up and crush them, and pretty much did. My guest is Jim Motovalli. He's the editor of E! Magazine, E! The Environmental Magazine. You can go to emagazine.com or my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com, and find out more information. We've got about 5 minutes left, Jim. And heretofore, as I said earlier, that the Bush administration pretty much denied that there was such a thing as global warming. Now there's stories in the news today, which I'm sure you've seen already, that the Yahoo News says Bush to address global warming in annual...
Well, he's addressing it. I see some actual some predictions on what he's likely to say. And he's not going to actually propose any really sweeping programs or anything like that. People who are looking forward to that, I think, are going to get disappointed.
Well, the other, in the Financial Times, White House denies claim of climate U-turn. And I have to say, I can't even understand what this is all about. Let me read this to you. Maybe you can shed some light on it. The White House on Tuesday denied it was planning a U-turn on its climate change policy by embracing a system of formal caps on greenhouse emissions despite rising pressure from European governments to change its stance. Now, what are we talking about here?
Well, let me quote from Tony Snow, the White House press secretary. And he was asked, and I'm sure this was yesterday, I think this was, he said the president would lay out our policy on global warming, but he said if you're talking about enforceable carbon caps in terms of industry-wide and nationwide, we knocked that down. That's not something we're talking about. So they're not talking about any sort of actual plan to reduce global warming. He may address the subjects. He might say we need to do something about it. He might appoint a commission to look into it, even though it's been studied to death and confirmed on every scientific panel. But what he's not going to do is anything that's really going to affect industry and force them to control emissions, I don't think.
Well, I know that the, and I'm forgetting the name of the official body that supervises the Great Lakes, the International Joint Commission, the IJC. They have an official policy that they have absolutely no enforcement policy for, of zero emissions into the Great Lakes basin. And there, I don't know if we could ever get that with our coal-burning plants, but certainly if the company spent billions of dollars with scrubbers and all sorts of other technology that would stop the kind of poisonous emissions that they're putting forth now, we could cut in a lot to our pollutions. And also, by the way, the coal company should eat the cost instead of passing it on to...
I'm not sure you're ever going to get to zero emissions with a coal plant.
No, but we could get a little better... And we are a lot better. But the same should be true for all these companies. I mean, they're part of their profitability is based on that they won't properly scrub the air that they're poisoning, right?
Yeah, no, definitely. And the Bush administration policy has not been to require that of them.
Yeah, but
They've bent over backwards to accommodate the industry.
One of the things we were talking about global warming, there are some people, of course, that deny that it happens, but I hear from a few days ago, a couple of weeks now, January 3rd, ExxonMobil Corporation gave $16 million to 43 ideological groups in between 98 and 2005 in a coordinated effort to mislead the public by discrediting the science behind global warming. So when we hear people, you know, you always get that he said, you know, this group says there is global warming, that group says there isn't. They're walking home with $16 million, the last group in their pockets. So
that is the, in terms of oil companies, that's the worst in terms of denying global warming. Every other oil company has made some kind of more conciliatory statement, and ExxonMobil is the last really vociferous holdout, as well as funder of global warming deniers.
Well, yeah. I guess, though, if you had to pay a retiring CEO a $400 million retirement fund, maybe you would get nervous about what was going to happen to your profitability. Actually, it's just pathology. I mean, because ones that are a little more green conscious, like BP, or at least the rhetoric, they figure they'll find some way to keep on making money in all of this, right?
Well, of course, BP was more than willing to drill in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge if they'd been allowed to. So even though BP now stands for Beyond Petroleum, I'm not sure whether they really deserve their green mantle either.
Let me say that because we're almost completely out of time, Jim Motivalli, I can't begin to say the appreciation that I have, and I'm sure your other readers do, of magazines like E! The Environmental Magazine and a host of others that let us know what's going on. Not only the problems, but one of the things I appreciate about your magazine is, like this one, Building Greener, that it proposes solutions. But I was listening last night to Ed Begley Jr., who is sort of suddenly a rising of the Mr. Environment. And
he wrote the foreword to Four-wheel drive, yeah.
Okay, great.
Great guy.
And but you know, he was saying that he doesn't, he won't fly. And some of my listeners saying, "Oh, you fly all over the world. You know, you're a hypocrite." What does it? And gee, we're really almost out of time for a big question like this. But our individual acts, how important are they?
They're very important, and there's lots of things you can do, including buying compact fluorescent bulbs, putting in an automatic thermostat, thinking of ways to turn the heat down and to drive less and to buy a more fuel-efficient car. There's lots of things individuals can do. Make your house more airtight, all that kind of stuff.
Hey, I walked to work. I froze my butt off.
Now, you deserve applause for that, Peter. That's very honorable of you.
Jim O'Devine.
Particularly in Detroit.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Again, it's E, the Environmental Magazine. You can go to emagazine.com. Thank you for being on the Peter Werbe Show.
Great of being on.
You're listening to WRIF.com.